The Augustin Hosinga Show with your host Augustin Hosinga.
Smack the shit out your bitch ass midget girlfriend, nigga.
Hello there, and welcome back to the Augustin Hosinga Show with I, your host, Augustin Hosinga, and this is episode number 755, that is Siete Cinco Cinco, with I, your friend, Augustin Hosinga, and this is the Augustin Hosinga Show. I hope you're doing well, wherever this show may find you. I hope you are doing splendid. How am I? All good, all things considered, all good, all things considered. I've had a bit of a crazy last few days. I'm not too sure if anybody's kind of recognized or realized or seen or heard or noticed, but I had a pretty crazy, pretty wild nasal infection, like a few days ago, which basically left me bedridden for most of the weekend, which basically affected my ability to make content, which affected my ability to work, which affected my ability to exist, to go to the gym, to run, to do all the things I love to do, because the front of my face felt like there was like an anvil. It felt like there was a fucking, there was a liquid, there was a gel that was all kind of, you know, compressed up in the front of my face, and it was almost kind of pushing against my fucking skull, and it wasn't kind of leaving me alone. It was absolutely horrible. Now, before any of you flipping smart, you know, smarty pants out there think, "Oh, Augustino, it's all the drugs. It's all the drugs." No, it actually wasn't the drugs. It actually was a really bad adverse effect to my constant allergies that seem to be all year round. It's absolutely annoying. And I know it's not the drugs, because whenever I have a nasal infection, whenever my sinuses go fucking crazy, or I have a sinus infection, not nasal infection, whenever I have a sinus infection, whenever I blow my nose, again, sorry for those of you eating, I apologize if you're eating, if you're drinking, please make sure you mute from now on. Whenever I am blowing my nose, when I've got a sinus infection, number one, my bogey is extremely green, and number two, it stinks. It's got a really weird smell to it. If you know about sinus infection, you know Wagwan. When it's to do with drugs, it's usually just runny nose, clear sort of stuff. You know what the vibes are. And I can definitely tell I'm way more like bunged up. But with this, it wasn't even like I was bunged up. It was more so like my head was just feeling like it was about to explode. Like I could just feel the sort of like liquid and the stuff and the whatever running around my flipping forehead and all my sinuses and stuff. It was absolutely horrible. Luckily, I was able to get myself better. I obviously took some paracetamol. I drank loads of water, which obviously clearly helps to get all that mucus out. I rested a bunch. And oddly enough, you know what I actually did that actually ended up working? I went to the gym. I went to the gym and got a bit of a sweat on, and it actually did help to sort of, I wouldn't say flush my system, because I think that term is something that is kind of overused and sometimes doesn't actually say what you're actually doing, and can sometimes lead to you making bad decisions and having bad habits when you're sick. But there is a benefit to being able to, if you can, work out, get your heart rate at a certain level, take your mind off obviously being ill, and just be able to somehow, I guess because you're working under strain, you have you're put in a position where you're kind of pushed to breathe out of your mouth, through your nose, in and out, whatever. Do you know what I mean? I think there's something to do with that respiratory thing that I was doing when I was working out that kind of helped me. And now I'm feeling a lot better. But it is a pretty annoying situation, because I promise you, a few years ago, I never had sinus issues. I'm not too sure if this is relating to the COVID jab. I'm not too sure if this is just an age thing, and sometimes you develop allergies over time. But I never ever had I never had allergy issues. I never had to carry an asthma pump with me. I never had to take anti-allergy tablets at all. And now I'm one of those type of dorks that have to go to the club with my little blue asthma pump, with my little blister of anti-allergy tablets, and I have to make sure I take them. Otherwise, I'll start coughing and heezing like I'm smoking when I'm actually not, and I've actually got allergies and my sinuses and my throat are on flipping fire. So that was me. That was upsetting, but I finally did get it done. I feel like Twitter's the best it's ever been because there's this element or this suggestion that it is the home of free speech, where people can say these kind of wild, quasi, you know, or blatant racist things about, remember when English teams had English players in it, and people can actually have a somewhat good faith debate around it. I would actually like that, you know? I actually don't mind that that's actually a situation or a thing that's actually happening now in real time. I don't actually mind it in the slightest. I'm not going to lie. I absolutely love it. Because I would actually love to see an English team devoid of any players with Irish background, any players with Northern Ireland background, any players with Scottish background, Welsh backgrounds. Obviously, African, Caribbean are completely out, and obviously mainland Europe, and what that actual team would look like. I think people would be really shocked at how terrible we would be. The England team's already quite bad now, and we basically have the best of the best that's available in the Premier League, playing on these shores, playing abroad, right? Anybody that's basically can qualify for the England team, with the exception of maybe Musiala, we've got everybody that's available, right? Everybody that's available that can play for England is currently playing for England. Some people even suggest that we have maybe one of the best generations in terms of talented players nowadays in the England team right now. Which is why a lot of people give Gareth Southgate so much stick, because they feel like he's wasting all of these players at their prime or soon to hit their prime, because he's quite an average coach and we haven't been able to win a major trophy since he's been in charge, despite the talent that's been at his disposal. But just in terms of a purely entertainment thing, just in terms of just seeing it, what it actually looked like, I would love to see a purely English, Anglo-Saxon, full white England team and see how far they go. I would go as far as saying that I don't think an all-white England team even qualifies for the Euros. Doesn't even qualify. That's my guess. A full-white England team, again, no Irish, no Scots, no Welsh, no mainland Europe, and of course, no African and Caribbean. I think they don't even qualify for the Euros, let alone the World Cup. They don't even qualify for the fucking Euros. I think Liechtenstein, Moldova, all these teams absolutely sweep England apart if we decide to go for a fully England, if you're not white, you're not English type of thing, which is interesting. But it's also funny because it does highlight the issues in terms of identification and, you know, and how people kind of see themselves in the UK. You don't really see a lot of people who are what you deem to be non-white calling themselves English. It's not really a thing. I'm sure most of you guys who are out there who maybe have lived in England or know people that live here would attest to that. There's not really a lot of like non-English people who would be comfortable enough to call themselves English. Most people who are non-white looking would describe themselves as British, firstly, as opposed to English, which is a shame, really, because, you know, we're from this fucking country. But unfortunately, with race and identity and nationality and all this malarkey, and obviously maybe a part of it might be to do with the royal family, might have something to do with the army, I don't really know. Either way, I think this conversation is another indication as to why Twitter is the best social media platform to go on, but it's also a cesspool of hate, a cesspool of racism, bigotry, sexism, and all the other isms under the sun. If you can handle all that shit, plus some creepos, I recommend you switch to Twitter. If you don't, you like some cool pictures, you want to see your friends, you want to, you know, send them emojis on their stories, stick to IG. But I think in terms of fun and value for money or value for time, you don't get much better. You don't get much better than fucking Twitter. Twitter is absolutely where it's at. I'm enjoying it, I'm loving it, and I'm happy that I've made the move over there, and it's my primary social media platform of that I kind of use on a daily basis. Another thing that I saw online that I wanted to comment on, just in terms of, you know, family dynamics and how hard that is to sort of like navigate and how difficult it is to kind of comment on when you're looking from the outside in. So I'm sure most of you guys have seen this story, courtesy of the Los Angeles Times. It says, why would Kobe Bryant's dad auction NBA championship rings Lakers legend gifted to him? So most of you are aware that unfortunately the basketball legend Kobe Bryant passed away a couple of years ago, or a few years ago, you know, due to tragic circumstances in a helicopter crash that also took the life of his young daughter and a few other people, I think members of the team or somebody that was in a helicopter together. Everybody in the helicopter obviously perished due to, if I'm not mistaken, I think they said in the final report that it was a really cloudy day, and, you know, maybe the pilot shouldn't have gone the direction they went in. Unfortunately, something happened and the helicopter ended up crashing, and we lost that legend. And I guess ever since then, I think in general, his death has been handled pretty graciously by his family. You don't really hear much crazy stuff happening with his in-laws, with his direct family, with the extended family. Everything seems to be handled with somewhat level of grace. This is the first time I've seen some stink around Kobe Bryant's name, and it's to do with his dad or his parents deciding to sell his NBA championship ring. And the sad thing about it is that Kobe Bryant is obviously a legend, and the fact that his parents are in a position where they have to sell the ring in order to eat, in order to survive, kind of is sad in itself. But then if you kind of, you know, dig a bit deeper and you kind of look into the story, what you'll find out is that Kobe Bryant was estranged from his parents at the time of passing. They did try and reconcile and mend the relationship, but they weren't really on good terms before he passed. And from what I can understand, a lot of it stems from Kobe Bryant marrying Vanessa Bryant, his widow at the moment, who's kind of handling all these affairs and shit. And Kobe Bryant's parents at the time, when he was proposing to her, weren't approving of their relationship. They probably thought she was a bad influence, thought she was maybe a slut, a video vixen, a whore, whatever. They just didn't like her in the first place. That obviously caused a rift between Kobe Bryant and his parents. And unfortunately, that rift was never really fully mended before he passed, which then affected the way Kobe Bryant looked after his parents. Now, some people would say you should never let those type of things affect the way you treat your family members, right? Some people should say that. And I would agree with that. I'm somebody that thinks, in life, you should have, it doesn't matter if it's your parents or it's your family or it's your siblings or it's your extended family or it's your friend, but there should be one group of people, or there should be a group of people who always get the benefit of doubt with you, who could always have a second, third, 100th, 1 millionth chance with you. There's always a road back to forgiveness. There's always a road back to how it was before. There should always be that person available, so that you know how to access that emotion, how to access that feeling, and how to kind of be that quote-unquote bigger person. Because I think if you can do that with one group of people, you could also be very cutthroat when somebody who isn't in that hallowed circle, who isn't in that very close-knit kind of group around you, does some fuck shit to you, you can cut them off immediately. Because you know what, like, because you know what, you know what it means to love somebody without any limit. You know what it means to love somebody to the point where it doesn't matter what they do to you wrong, you're always going to forgive them. You have to have the ability to love that one person like that, or a group of people like that, so that you can cut off people who fuck you over and whatever it may be, you know, even minor inconveniences, you can kind of quickly cut them off because you have, I guess, somewhat of a high level of expectation in terms of what you can tolerate from your family. I don't know. Hopefully you kind of get what I mean. So if that's one side. But there are some people out there that think, especially in the black community, we are way too forgiving to our family and friends. Yeah? Which I also do believe. And I think there are some family and friends within the black community that unfortunately do take advantage of that door always being slightly ajar. Doesn't matter what they do to you, they know deep down you're never going to fully cut them off. It might take a year, it might take 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, but they know you're always going to come back around. And I think those people take advantage of that sort of thing, exploit people, manipulate people, and obviously that isn't great. But I would then say, as a pushback against that, it's a case-by-case thing. And I think sometimes we also have to be very clear, grown up, and adult enough and accepting enough to understand that sometimes some people's relationships with their family, with their friends, with their siblings, with their loved ones can sometimes be so toxic, there is no saving it. And sometimes it's best for everybody just to let it be how it be. I think this idea of like trying to mend things, let's get back, like always trying to like, I won't say force the issue, but make it right, can sometimes make things worse. Sometimes if things are the way they are, like I don't really believe in the whole ghosting thing. I think that's really lame. I think you should always make your intentions clear what you want. And if you don't want certain things, you should be also clear about, hey, I don't want this thing. I don't want to talk to you anymore. I'm not interested. I think that's very, very important. I think nowadays people are way too pussified. They don't really have courage. They don't really have balls to actually say what they want, say what they don't want, blah, blah. Hence why the whole ghosting thing exists. But part of ghosting that also makes it somewhat beneficial is that it does avoid awkward conversations that don't need to happen. Because sometimes saying things can make things far worse than you kind of clocking Wagwan. Like if somebody decides to ghost you because they're not really interested anymore, it might be actually better for your mental, for your self-esteem, for your, you know, whatever, to just assume that they don't want to talk to you anymore, hence why they're not replying to your texts, as opposed to them actually sitting you down, looking you in the eye and saying, hey, you're fucking ugly, I'm not really that into you, you're not attractive to me, you don't turn me on, I can't see my future in you at all. Like, that kind of directness can maybe hurt you more than you actually think it will, because you're thinking you want honesty, you're thinking you want directness, you're thinking you want all that shit. When someone does it, it can kind of throw you off the loop and kind of affect you, you know, for years to come. So maybe sometimes with families and friends and whatnot, it's actually better when things just get left to kind of slowly die. Weird way to say this, but sometimes it is possible that to be the case, especially when you see the amount of toxicity that exists online with some people and their families and stuff airing out their personal dramas. Some people's families are just beyond reproach. They're beyond saving. And I think there is an inability to accept that reality, especially within a black community, that, hey, some people just don't get on, or some people get to a point in life where they don't get on anymore, and that's perfectly okay. But I feel like the majority of us, 99% of us, myself included, probably should be people who have family as that one group of people who can never do wrong by you, who you could always forgive, who there's always a door open for, who whatever, do you know what I mean? Like, that person should also always exist in your life, because I feel like nowadays people are so transactional in their relationships and their friendships. There's no real loyalty. You know, all this sort of stuff that exists online, it's all kind of fleeting friendship moments, experiences. It's somewhat important to have a group of people, a person in your life who you're going to be ride or die for, right or wrong. You're going to be by their side. They can be by your side no matter what they do wrong. You can always forgive them, understand them, and hear them out, blah, blah, blah. I think that's really, 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 really bloody important. But in this case, it's made more muddy because I guess from what I'm led to understand, Vanessa Bryant has basically been left in charge of the entirety of Kobe Bryant's fortune. And if the parents didn't like Kobe Bryant's wife before they got married, and she's very aware of that to the point where I don't think they even came to the wedding, which is a big deal for a lot of people, you would imagine, it's very difficult to not see that be a bit of an issue. Because maybe Kobe Bryant would have been okay to forgive his parents at one point, but she doesn't know these people. They're Kobe Bryant's parents. They're not her parents. Even though they're her in-laws, they're not really, you know, she doesn't fucking know them. They don't have a relationship. She doesn't really, quote unquote, owe them anything. So that's where it gets a little bit sad and a little bit bad, because this person that already has an axe to grind with these people because they don't like her first now has more of an axe to grind because the person that was maybe holding them together or maintaining some semblance of relationship has now gone and is no longer with us. So now you're in a position where you have all the money, you have all the access to all the fucking wealth and shit, and you're giving to the parents. I don't know. I feel like if that was me and the parents got into this type of situation, reluctantly, I would help them out so they don't have to sell stuff like this, because, you know, Kobe Bryant's legacy, you know, is tied to these sort of bits of memorabilia, like these NBA championship rings that you would assume most basketballers only give to their close family and friends. So to sell this sort of stuff just to pay the mortgage, just so you can go on holiday, just so you can buy groceries, just feels like a gross you know, it just feels kind of gross, kind of sad, and obviously doesn't honor his legacy, and it's just unnecessary, especially if there's money enough to give you so you don't have to sell this sort of stuff, so you can kind of remember him for the good times, and every time you see this thing on your fucking mantelpiece or in your jewelry box, you can think back to him and shit. All those things are really important, those type of bits of memorabilia. Maybe this might be an actual person. This might be pretty cool. Imagine if the person that actually buys this decides to kind of just give it back to the family and says, hey, I love Kobe. I'm going to give the ring back to you, and then if you guys pass away, just give the ring back to me then when you guys go and you're not around anymore. But whilst you're still here, you can keep a hold of it so you can always remember him. Do you know what I mean? No questions asked. That would be fucking awesome. Or maybe even the wife does it, Vanessa Bryant. But this just proves that family is just it's a hard thing to kind of wrangle. It's a hard thing to kind of work out. And I guess everybody has their way of dealing with these type of things. But I just don't know. I just don't know what the right answer is. Let's read the article here. It says, what on earth would prompt Joe Jellybean Bryant to auction the 2000 NBA championship ring his son Kobe gifted to him? Is the father of the Lakers legend signaling that he and Kobe's mom, Pamela, are in financial straits and need the estimated 200,000 could fetch to make ends meet? And that's the thing that makes it sad. It's not that the ring, you know, it's obviously the ring, the sense of the value of it. It's only, quote unquote, being estimated to be sold for 200,000. So this is proof that it's not as if they're trying to get millions to kind of, you know, set themselves up for life. So they don't have to ask Vanessa Bryant for money anymore. This sounds like they actually need, like, living day-to-day money if they're selling it for 200,000, especially when you consider their Kobe Bryant's children, sorry, their Kobe Bryant's parents, the level of wealth they've been used to. The fact that they're selling it and it's only estimated for 200,000 means that they need that 200,000. Is an attempt to embarrass Kobe Bryant's widow, Vanessa, into gifting them a slice of the estimated $600 million estate Kobe left her when he died in a helicopter crash. Wow. $600 million. Okay, the wife is being a bit crazy. If the parents hate you, I understand, but you could always write a check, even in anger. Even if you don't like the person, you could always write them a check and say, hey, get fucked, don't talk to me anymore. Here's fucking 10 mil. But come on, man. I understand you're also grieving, but come on. Without question, it's just the latest chapter, in a choppy relationship Kobe's parents had with their son during his 20-year Lakers career and marriage to Vanessa, whom he met in 1999 and married in 2001. His parents were famously absent at the wedding ceremony in Dana Point, the same auction firm Joe and Pamela Bryant used 11 years ago in the aborted attempt to sell the same ring and dozens of other items related to Kobe, put the 2000 championship ring up for sale on March 9th. The initial bid is $33,000 and 12 bids later, it's up to $94,000. Bidding ends on the 30th of March. The 14-carat gold ring features 40 diamonds and includes inscriptions, the Lakers, Bryant, World Champions, and Bling Bling. What's it worth? In 2019, Pamela Bryant auctioned a replica 2000 championship ring gifted by her son that sold for 206. So she sold a replica for 206,000 and the real one's going to go for 300 grand. That seems like a bit of an undervaluation, though, a little bit, right? Neither Bryant's parents nor Vanessa have commented publicly about the story. Social media fans' reaction is mixed. So yeah, I don't know what the right solution is. If the parents legitimately need to eat, and you know this ring can allow them to, you know, have a little bit more runway, I guess. He's not here anymore anyway. It's just a fucking ring. It doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. It's just more sad for his legacy and for the fact that he left them such, or that he left behind such a, you know, big fucking war chest and empire in terms of wealth and stuff. I didn't know he left them that much money in the 600 millions in terms of, I guess, the assets and everything else he has, and maybe quick, and then maybe just straight up cash. The fact that they have to sell this is a sad thing. That's the real, real sad thing about this whole story. Hope they work it out. Most likely they won't, especially if it's got to this level, because usually in most cases, deaths and passings of people in family usually bring people together. Even if people have been on the, you know, on opposite ends of the fucking spectrum and haven't been talking to each other for a long time, sometimes a death can bring everybody together and people let people know, hey, let bygones be bygones. It's not that big of a deal. Things could be far worse. Look at the time we wasted. Da, 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 da. And the fact that that hasn't happened in the wake of Kobe's death is probably proof that these people are real rap enemies. Like real rap enemies. And there's no fixing it. Zero. The fact that they haven't even fixed it now to this point, and the fact that no one's come out yet from Vanessa's side trying to, like, you know, I don't know, trying to counteract this story and make it look good by saying that she's stepping in to help the fact that nothing has happened is proof that they don't talk to each other at all. So that's a sad thing about this whole situation, because it also means their kids don't have a relationship with their own grandparents and stuff. Do you know what I mean? On their dad's side, which is a little bit of a shaky one as well, especially considering how high profile they are. But I guess with these situations, it kind of is what it kind of is. Going on from that one, let's talk a little bit about this T-Rail and fucking Big Deal thing. So I'm sure most of you guys are aware that back on Fig Show, T-Rail and his older brother, Big Deal, got into a really heated argument that I never really spoke about, I think, on the pod itself. And this heated argument has now spiraled into Big Deal being kicked out of the whole Back on Fig team. He's now has appeared on No Jumper, which is obviously T-Rail's Mortal Enemy platform. He sat down with Adam 22 and let him quiz and grill him about his relationship with his brother. He sent out some, you know, not so nice kind of messages on his Instagram stories. He said some not nice things on lives and shit. I think in response, I think T-Rail maybe had got his channel deleted on YouTube. There's been a real, a real kind of breakdown in communication. Their relationship has got to a point where it's maybe beyond repair. But this is the initial conversation or the initial argument that kind of spurned all the beef. This is the initial argument that spurned all the beef. And it's quite sad to see brothers kind of arguing in this way. But maybe it is kind of normal as well in some respects. But I want to just comment on the other side about just how difficult it must be navigating this particular type of relationship. So let's play the clip and you can hear these guys arguing.
Finish that situation.
Like who?
Straight up, nigga.
Like who? Finish my situation.
Nigga, that situation with the nigga pulling up to your house, nigga.
What you
straight
mean?
Straight up, nigga. You forced out, nigga. Nigga, shut up.
What
nigga,
the fuck
mark,
you talking
nigga, straight
about?
Up, nigga.
I have my motherfucking burner out.
Man, marked out, bro.
What the fuck you talking
nigga,
about, nigga?
Man.
You was with me in the motherfucking
man,
in the garage, nigga.
I don't want to hear none of that,
fuck
nigga.
What you talking about?
Nigga, I pulled up. Nigga, what's happening?
I had my motherfucking
nigga, I pull
shit
up to any location, nigga.
And where was the location? We was looking for
nigga,
the location.
Nigga, so what? Nigga, I still get with him. Nigga, that shit ain't over with,
well,
nigga.
Let's get with him.
Nigga, you ain't doing nothing,
what you
nigga.
Talking about?
I'm really
you want to put it on
doing,
the internet?
You ain't doing nothing, nigga.
What you mean,
nigga?
Where's
nigga,
that?
Because I want to keep an internet, nigga, for the soft niggas.
What you
that's
talking
why,
about?
Nigga. I
that's
want to get on that
tight.
Motherfucker and pop my shit.
That's
and let that
tight,
nigga know, nigga. How it ain't tight.
That's
he put it on the internet.
What you talking about?
Nigga, I was
tight?
Gonna tell that nigga he wasn't gangster for that nigga on the internet. You didn't even want me to
what
do that.
What you talking
nigga?
About? Why?
Stop playing, nigga.
You could have did anything you wanted to do.
Man, stop playing.
Nigga? When that bitch
nigga,
was on your
playing.
Head, because that
stop
bitch was
playing.
On your
nigga,
head.
You didn't want me to speak on it.
That bitch was on your head.
Yeah, but you gonna call
but
me though.
But you never said
but you gonna call me though.
But
you gonna call me
nothing.
For something though. You said
but
that.
You never said,
you said that, nigga. You said that on Truth in the Detail. You gonna call me. I ain't calling no
nigga.
Straight up, nigga.
About?
I ain't calling
would?
Nobody, nigga.
I ain't never called you in my motherfucking life until I got.
So, as you can tell, two brothers really going at it, arguing. It got sometimes very, very heated, very disrespectful. I guess T-Roll has basically said that his brother's dead to him at this point. There's no coming back. I think Keem did a good job the other day of getting T-Roll to open up about it and talk about it on their new show that they've got. I forgot the name of it with Pun as well. And T-Roll did try to sound somewhat understanding of what was happening and maybe open to the idea of maybe reconciling. But you could tell by how he was speaking, like his relationship with his brother is fucking done. So I was thinking about it and I was thinking, you know what? It must be kind of wild in some cases if you've got that kind of relationship with your brother. Because at the heart of it, it does sound like there is pure jealousy involved. Or maybe both sides. Maybe there's a... What's a jealousy? Maybe there's a feeling of... Yeah, maybe there is. It's kind of like a jealousy thing. Or even on T-Rail's side, in terms of like... Because of his injury, his motorcycle accident, he's now kind of handicapped. He can't really use his left arm. So maybe he feels a little bit subservient. Maybe he feels a little bit dependent on his brother to kind of handle his beefs or to just be there for him because he can't defend himself the way he used to defend himself in the past. Maybe in the terms of Big Deal side... Because he's the bigger brother, he also maybe feels like T-Rail maybe is like way too rich and successful compared to him, despite him being the guy that put more of the work in on the streets, despite him being well-known in the hood, whatever that shit is. That could also be a genuine point of contention between the both of them. That might be part of it. But I can't just imagine. I personally cannot imagine being fundamentally jealous of my brother to the point where I'm conspiring against him online. I'm plotting for his downfall and key-keying with the enemy online just because we had a spat. It wouldn't go that far. You're allowed not to talk to each other. You're allowed to air each other. You're allowed to maybe, you know, give each other the fucking cold shoulder. Maybe even come to blows. But to the point of, like, legitimately going to the mortal enemy in Adam 22, sitting down with him and knowing what that's going to do to relationship with you and your brother, knowing that's how that's going to look, that's a little bit crazy. That's a little bit crazy. That's a little bit crazy, in my personal opinion. I could be wrong. I don't really know what I'm talking about, but I think it's a bit crazy. But then I also understand and respect and acknowledge that I'm not there. I'm not in their relationship. I'm not in their household. I don't know what goes on behind the scenes, what goes on behind closed doors, the little fuck shit that's happened. Because sometimes, especially with siblings and even close friends, it's never just one situation that makes you blow up. It's always a buildup of shit. Something, this happened, that happened. And then it gets to a point where you just can't take it anymore and you explode. But it's very rarely one thing. So most likely there was other things that happened behind the scenes that we don't really know about, that we're not really familiar with, that maybe has led to this situation being what it is. It's just unfortunate that fucking Adam 22 has managed to fucking worm his way in there and kind of be a part of this whole thing when it has absolutely nothing to do with him. That's the only thing that kind of annoys me about this whole situation. I just wish he wasn't involved. I just wish he had no part to play in this. But unfortunately, you know, that guy is always going to be somewhat involved with some respect. Yo, big up Al. Appreciate you, Al.
Found you from Chin's Fish Cook video. Nice channel.
Big up Al. Appreciate you, family. Thank you for joining. And thank you for the flipping super chat. Much appreciated, my friend. Much appreciated. Anyway, let's move on from that one. Let's casually, sweetly, hurriedly move on from that little one that we did over there. Let's continue. And again, if you're enjoying the show and you like what you see, please make sure you like it and smash the like button down below. I'd be much appreciated. So, continuing on from that one, I also wanted to quickly talk about this clip. So this is courtesy of Hot New Hip Hop. And this is courtesy of JT from the City Girls. As most of you guys will know, the City Girls have kind of broken up now. JT and Young Miami have kind of gone off to do their own thing. I think JT is taking her solo career a little bit more seriously than Young Miami, I'd imagine. Young Miami probably has a lot more stuff on her plate to deal with the whole Diddy thing and all that stuff that's happening. Maybe she has to kind of navigate those waters a little bit more difficult. But JT seems to be really on her shit. She's kind of been embraced a lot by the fashion crowd. She's done a lot of work with kind of getting the name out there. She's been popping up at fashion weeks. She's got singles out. She's got visuals. She's cut clearly doing the work to kind of push herself as a solo artist, which I love. Now, there's been a lot of controversy around her because she's meant to be going on tour recently, or she's meant to be going on tour soon, in a couple of days actually. And people notice on the line, on the kind of on the list of locations that she's going to be hitting in America, that some of the locations included like bars and shit. They weren't like arenas or big clubs and shit that she was performing at. She was performing, or big theatres or whatever maybe. She was performing in like regular type of bars. And a lot of people were kind of astounded that an artist from the City Girls, with the amount of big records they've been on and all the co-signs that they've got, that a solo act from that group would have to kind of start at that level. When I personally saw it myself, I thought it was great to see. Because I thought it was quite refreshing to see an artist of that caliber decide to actually go and do the real work to actually build a legit fan base and touch the people, as opposed to try and book these really big, fancy, huge fucking venues for the vanity, for the ego, only to not be able to sell it and then have to cancel the date just to appear like you're a big deal. By actually doing these smaller club gigs where most of the rooms are 500 capacity and lower, it ensures that you have the ability to actually build a fan base organically the right way, so that in 5 to 10 years time, that audience will actually grow with you along the way, and they'll be your ride or die fans, because nowadays people don't do that anymore. The only bad thing, I guess, with it is that it does go to show that a lot of the City Girls' success early on was smoke and mirrors. A lot of it was kind of perception, a lot of it was clever marketing, a lot of it was branding, because really and truly, if you think about it, for a group like the City Girls, for one person to leave and then have to do gigs where they're performing in front of 300 people, that's a bit of an L. It's not necessarily the greatest thing. You don't really want to be shouting about that from the rooftop. So the fact that she has to do it is more so a bad indication as to the mismanagement of the City Girls, the mismanagement of their own personal careers and artistry and how they kind of present themselves, whatever out there. But I also think it's really humble, and it shows somebody that clearly wants to be in it in the long run. Because that's what I see. When I see JT doing these gigs at these smaller venues, right, I personally think it's a clear indication that she's really intent on being here for the long run. She doesn't want to be like a fly-by-night kind of person. She definitely is here for the long run. That's why she's doing these smaller venues, because the hope is that doing these smaller venues will lead to a possibility of her maybe going on bigger tours, performing at all these other crazy places and shit. I actually really don't mind it in the slightest. I really fucking don't. And I'm actually eager to see if the fans are going to resonate or are going to kind of back her up on that and support it, because that's also a fun thing for fans to be able to see an artist during their inception kind of build their fan base very slowly. That's actually something you don't actually get to see, because a lot of artists, they come out from the jump already polished, already very well kind of presented, already looking very industry planty. You don't really get to grow with an artist in a somewhat quasi-organic way anymore. So it's actually quite cool to see her doing this. And like I said before, it's actually a hint or a sign that she wants to do this for the long term. As you can see here from the tour poster, some of the locations featured, I'll read them out because I'm sure some of you will recognize the names. Houston, Texas, the place called the Sakai. Houston, Texas. Let's just see what that looks like. Houston, Texas, the Sakai. Let's see what that looks like. This looks more like a venue, to be fair. It's an outdoor seat. Okay, it's kind of like a bar as well. They serve cocktails and shit. So this should be still a fun venue to perform at. I'm not going to lie. It still kind of looks like a really fun venue to perform at, but it's not what you would describe as a big theater arena place that you would imagine a celebrity of her kind of ilk would be at in the first place. But it's still a good start. Other places you got here, a place called The Garden. You got a place called Club Elevation in Jacksonville, Florida. You've got Tally Home in Tampa. You've got Ace Spade in Detroit. You've got a place called Carroll City Park in Miami. You've got a place called Icons in Baltimore, a place called The Hagar in New York. Let's see what that actually looks like. The Hagar. What's The Hagar? The Hagar, New York. Let's see what this looks like. Is that what it's called? The Hagar? Or did I get that wrong? It's called The Harbor. Yo, big up God's Known. Appreciate you, brother.
English Black Red Bar.
Yes, I'll take that all day long. I'll take that all day long. Thank you for the super chat, my friend. I appreciate you joining. So this is The Harbor. Let's actually see what this looks like. The Harbor. Let me see here. It's not loading. It's being annoying. There we go. Okay, The Harbor. I don't know what the venue is. That's what it's called. Or did I type it in wrong? The Harbor, New York City. Okay, it's called The Harbor without the U. The Harbor. Let's see venue. Let's write that in there. Maybe it'll come up that way. The Harbor venue. Okay, yeah, so it's just like again, regular bar, clubby type of environment. Again, if she smashes it, if the visuals are good, a great DJ, decent after party and shit, I think it would actually go off and people will really enjoy it. So I'm happy to see that. Anyway, long story less long, she did clap back really well. Oh, big up Wingus McDingus, appreciate you too, brother.
Bean cheese, 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 bean cheese.
Yeah, bro. Wagwan, bean cheese mandem. You know, we're out here. We're ea. Big up Wingus McDingus. Appreciate you, my family. Appreciate you. So, JT did clap back really well via her social media online, which I kind of want to read through now, courtesy of Hot New Hip Hop, when somebody basically said, oh, are you guys going to go see this woman that's only got 3 songs performed on this tour? And which is understandable, because I think she actually only has 3 songs solo, but I'm assuming the rest of the set will be unreleased records, maybe some City Girls tunes as well, because why the fuck not? Maybe Young Miami might actually pop out, who knows? But I do like her reply back to the person who kind of said what they said about her only having 3 songs, and she said this, which I really did like as a response. Very catty, very bitchy, but a lot of truth in this. JT says on Twitter, and when the person says, are you going to go see this person that only has 3 songs go perform on tour? And she said, yes. Y'all go see bitches with no songs, pour liquor down their throat, but y'all draw the line with my great music. Go sit your goofy ass down, be trying to be so different. Matter of fact, come work the door. I definitely agree with her. If it's okay for, you know, IG baddies to go and do nightclub walkthroughs, to just go and do appearances and shit at clubs and not sing with no records, not doing anything apart from looking really hot or cute in the outfits, then what's different from an artist who's just started solo, right? Just in recent kind of months and shit, trying to take their songs out to the audience or to the public, or trying to touch their audience, sorry, and connect with their fan base and kind of grow it organically. What's wrong with that, really, if you think about it? Nothing, really. So I'm eager to see how it grows, how this kind of evolves. I'm also think a lot of people in the industry will have their eye on this, especially A&Rs, especially managers of artists who are maybe much smaller than a JT, who have probably been bugging their manager about doing certain tours, about supporting certain big acts. There's probably going to be a lot of managers looking at this with a very with a keen eye, wanting to kind of prove to their fucking clients that, look, do the actual work, go back to the basics, actually perform for a fucking audience, build your audience slowly, and that's when you kind of win in a big way long term. Rushing things and trying to do things super fast doesn't really get anywhere. So hopefully this works out for JT, because I think there's a lot riding on this for other artists too, as lame and as gay as that may sound. Moving on from that, another update regarding the Yes Jules thing. So the Yes Jules v Kanye thing has been really interesting, or the Yes Jules v Ye thing has been really interesting, just for the mere fact that when you really analyze it, there's not much reason why this girl should be that bothered or that annoyed about losing a job, apart from the fact that she lost a job working for somebody so influential, working for such an amazing, working during such an amazing period where they're rolling out, you know, free volumes of fucking Vultures and shit. Like, it's a bad time to leave, right? And to kind of be ousted from Yeezy, especially considering as well, they have other questionable people they already had working there. To be the first person that kind of gets publicly fired in that way, bit of an L. But apart from that, your only difference is he's not feeling you. He didn't like how you talked to the fans. He told you to skedazzle. It is what it is. For some reason, Yes Jules is still trying to prove that she didn't do a bad job and that she got unfairly fired in the court of public opinion, which is odd. And then she did a really weird, lame, corny thing online where she basically said, hey, I'm going to really speak my piece. I'm going to really kind of go out there and speak from the heart and show you all the evidence, all the screenshots about why I was wrong, then blah, 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 about why this person is, why this person is. And I think at the end of it, it was like, yeah, sign up to my Snapchat. So she used all this kind of, you know, attention on her, all the questions around the scandal side of her getting fired, to kind of funnel it all back to her Snapchat, which is essentially her, like, PG version of an OnlyFans, where she kind of does like bespoke content, some of it obviously showing her body and some of it mostly like around like marketing and branding and whatever when it comes to sort of music stuff. So, but in general, it just looks a little bit weird, a little bit lame. So somebody luckily was able to pull some of that stuff from Snapchat and post on Twitter, because most of us aren't going to download Snapchat to go watch a Yes Jules story or download Snapchat full stop. So thank you for everyone that did that. And one person that did do it was this account on Twitter called Yeezy Johnny. So they posted some of the screenshots that Yes Jules put out there. The caption by Yeezy Johnny says the follows: Yes Jules violating an NDA on Snapchat after Ye posted a lawsuit against her is very unwise in my opinion. She leaked file name for a new body and text between Yeezy team and her and Ye. So let's read through the texts, because I think the texts are fucking hilarious, because it's always good to see how these people communicate behind the scenes if you get a chance. It's just kind of funny to see that most of the time, especially in Kanye's case, he is exactly the same way in DMs, on SMS, on iMessage, than he is when he speaks in front of a camera. It's basically, if anything, it's sometimes a bit more ramped up because he knows he's not, you know, under the scrutiny of the public eye and shit. So let's see. This is one text between Yes Jules and Ye. She says to Ye, packing for airport, should I be prepared to go to Saudi with the team? So it seems like even at this point, this is December 14th, Yes Jules wasn't on good terms with the team, or in good standing, let's say, to the point where she had to request from Ye directly, hey, do you want me to come to Saudi Arabia with you guys? Or, do you know what I mean? Like, she's not really in the inner circle. You know, you go wherever Ye goes, type of thing. she kind of gets brought along when they kind of want her or when they can tolerate her. And any other time, she kind of gets left to the side. That's what I'm reading into. Again, it's only one text. It could be nothing. Doesn't mean anything. He said yes. Then she posts, I guess, a link to Tiger's number. Then Kanye posts a link to Newbody. The caption on this from Snapchat says, I was asked to assist with the event in Vegas, which was also planned by his team, and I simply assisted the inviting the artist, doing my best to assist them with logistics for attending. So she's suggesting that, hey, Kanye was already organizing this event in Saudi Arabia, had nothing to do with me. I was just assisting and inviting other artists to join. So I guess, again, she's doing that thing that she does quite often. I think there is a lack of... One of the things, I guess, is one of her faults. Maybe because she's answering too many people online at the same time. She doesn't take a lot of accountability for her own actions. It's always somebody else's fault for misunderstanding, misrepresenting, reading too much into it. It's always that sort of thing. It's never her saying, oh, yeah, you know what? I fucked up there. I probably sent that text wrong. I probably shouldn't have followed that person. I didn't follow through on this thing. Like, it's mostly everyone else's fault and not hers. And she just, you know, whatever. Or maybe that's what you have to do in that world. Maybe in that world of like celebrity marketing, influencing, activation, you kind of have to be very quick to say, hey, that wasn't me. Because if you do let people blame you for certain things, that might affect your ability to get hired in other jobs because you might have that stink on you. Maybe. I don't know. I'm just talking out my ass. Next screenshot here between Yes Jules and Ye. Yes, Ye says he's 30 minutes out. She texts him and says, anything to drink? Any songs you want to hear as you are entering? And he says, make it go silent. Just all silent. Carti here? Question mark. And she says, done. So she's trying to be accommodating, be a bit of an assistant. Hey, do you want a drink? Blah, blah. He said, just make it fucking silent. He asks if Carti's there. So clearly more proof that Carti is just elusive and mysterious with everybody. So Aiden Ross should probably be a little bit more understanding about how Carti is and shouldn't take it personally. Carti is a diva and a big timer, and he egos and he kind of like stunts on just about everybody. I don't really personally like it when people do that sort of stuff anyway. I think that whole purposefully mysterious, I can be a cunt to you because I'm socially awkward type of thing is fucking lame. But it is proof that even Ye doesn't know where Carti is. Yes, no, he has asked Yes Jules. So, she says done, doesn't answer the Carti question, so he repeats it and writes Carti's full name. Is Playboy Carti here? Then she replies an explanation. I have not been able to confirm that. When I called them a few hours ago, they said that they had no idea it was still happening. I'm sorry. I wish it was involved from the beginning. I would have made sure he was here. Lots of great people were here ready to see you. So I guess maybe she's not including the part of the messages where she was maybe in charge of making sure Carti got there, because it sounds like Ye thought she would know. Maybe Carti was on her list of people that she had to kind of get over the line. I don't know. Either way, it seems like, you know, she was copying a lot of pleas there. There's a big amount of text there that he's not replying to. He replies and says, we in front and don't know where to go. And then she replies and says, I have platform and deep and booth completely cleared and mic in hand. Where are you? I've been waiting at the artist entrance. I did the best I could for you, but if you let me lead, I can be far better. So happy that you came in with us, heart. So I guess this is proof that at one point, Ye did like her and did like her working and was appreciative of her getting involved and leading certain things and getting them over the line. Another screenshot shows Ye saying, everybody cap, sabotage two events in a row. Ye was rightfully pissed off and exiled the majority of the team for the chat. If I can't work it out, there's a problem with that. Pass your video along. So then Ye, the funny thing about this is that Ye says that, right? Everybody caps, sabotage two events in a row. Then Ye goes on his group chat thing and look who he removes. He removes all these people. Latif, Samassi, Kyrie Create Marketing, Hamid Bello, Ryan Han. All these people get deleted from the fucking group chat because Ye's so happy. I love how he kind of acts like in real life, like his little fucking tantrums, right? This grown-ass man, like, removing people from the fucking group chat when he's fucking rid of them and he's fucking, you know, they haven't maybe helped him kind of achieve his goals and shit. So that's the basically extent of most of it. And I guess the last screenshot to kind of recap on this is Yeezy Johnny has posted a proof courtesy of Kanye defense team. And again, proof with, you know, what you call it? Proof in brackets, because we don't know Wagwan. It says here, allegedly, this proves that Yeezy Jules did sign an NDA. And we've got here screenshots, I guess, from the NDA document. One on the left here with her name, Juliana Goddard, and another one here with her name as well. So they're alleging that she actually did sign an NDA, so she's liable, and that she has to, you know, face the music when it comes to this $8 million fucking court case. Pretty crazy, pretty wild. I don't think it's going to go that far. I think if anything, it's just a sign or an indication of how annoyed Ye and maybe Team Yeezy was with her at that time. I think in general, they'll probably drop it because, you know, court cases are expensive. They take up time. It's probably going to cause her a lot of headache. She probably might reach out and say, hey, guys, let's resolve this amicably. But it is maybe a situation that she should probably take a back to take the foot off the pedal a little bit and not be so quick to sort of defend yourself in public, because it doesn't matter now. It's in the courts. Defend yourself there and kind of clear your name there as best as you can. But I think online, her perception is her perception. For better or worse, kind of deal with it, make it work for yourself. Because I think she did really well so far, making it work for herself, right? Being this kind of sexy girl that does marketing for musicians and shit, and does like branding and activations for them. She has done that pretty well, kind of using her body as kind of like a Trojan horse. And then when you kind of get closer and look into it, it's all kind of marketing, inspirational, blah, blah, you know, quasi kind of Christian single mom talk. So she does that really well. I think now the game or the key should be just to kind of like pull away from all this stuff. Stop trying to defend yourself against, you know, Kanye fan pages who are, by their very definition, you know, ride or die Kanye fans and will never ever side with you, especially when he's been so publicly against you. So just allow all that and kind of keep it moving. But I guess it's maybe easier said than done, especially when somebody of the caliber of Ye is publicly besmirching your name with the backing of a Milo, and obviously with one of the biggest and most fucking powerful fan bases that exist out there. I don't understand why she's finding it hard to just like shut the fuck up, but I think she should shut the fuck up. Anyway, moving on from this, I've been watching a little bit of Masters of the Air, and I have to be honest, I'm finding it hard to get through it. Even though it's a series that's right up my alley, it's a little mini series. I think they said they're going to do a season two, which they probably shouldn't, personally, in my opinion. It should be a little standalone series, but it's a really good one. It's based on, I think, World War II, regarding a specific Air Force regiment, and it's starring two very, 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 very attractive lead actors in the roles, being Austin Butler and Callum Turner. Austin Butler, of course, most of you know for the Elvis movie, and also he's in Dune. And then Callum Turner, I think some of you guys know as being Dua Lipa's new boyfriend, I'd assume. I personally find it very hard to watch Masters of the Air because those guys are just too young looking and also too good looking to make that role or to make those characters believable. If that makes any sense. And I don't know if this is my kind of unaddressed homosexuality kind of coming out to this fucking forefront, or if it's something other people have noticed. But when it comes to like war movies and stuff, when the guys are like too chiseled, when they look too much like fucking models and shit, it's hard to kind of believe what you're watching, because, you know, is that normal for fucking the army to be hiring fucking, you know, models from fucking Elite and shit? Or like, you know, twinks and stuff in their main roles. I'm not really too sure. Especially when some of the outfits some of the outfits that they're wearing in the actual series kind of sits a bit baggy on them. They don't really fill it out as much. It just doesn't really seem that believable. If that's something that I can say without sounding crazy. Because again, I tried to watch it the other day, tried to get into it, but I just couldn't commit because those guys are just too damn good looking. It just kind of takes you out of it and you start to think, shit, bro, imagine being born looking like that. And then you're like, why would you go in the army if you actually just look like that? You know what I mean? Why would you do that? It makes no sense. But anyway, regardless, it's kind of, I guess it's okay so far from what I've seen. I'm only about two episodes in. Not as good as some other, World War II, World War I type of movies I've basically watched in the past. But very, very enjoyable and okay so far. Next on the list, we have this regarding X-Men 97. Have you been watching X-Men 97? Do you guys like X-Men 97? Personally, having watched one episode, I've got one more to go. I don't know if I like it. I feel like they rushed way too much into that one episode. I don't like the way they really heavy-handedly introduced all the characters on this episode. Like, where every time a character came in, they said their name. Hey, Cyclops, what are you doing in the kitchen? Hey, Rogue, put down that... You know, it's like, it seemed a little bit too crazy. Maybe it was a callback to how cartoons back then were done, but I didn't really fucking like it. The whole conflict and drama between all the X-Men is a little bit annoying too. Somewhat refreshing to see that beef between Cyclops and Wolverine over Jean and shit, like how they're, you know, how Wolverine is secretly in love with her and shit. But I feel like it's going to be a little bit too soppy for me. I don't know. A little bit too soppy. It's a little bit too much jam-packed and rammed into it to make it make sense. I'm just not feeling it so far. I haven't been feeling it. And I feel like the episodes are kind of rushed. I really have to be honest. I really feel like episodes are kind of rushed. One good thing I like about it, though, to be fair, to give it a little bit of credit, I really do like the Cyclops character. It's good to see Cyclops not be a pussy. He's really angry. He's got like a chip on his shoulder. He's very much, he's got this kind of, he thinks he can do no wrong type of thing. Which is something that you get a lot in the comics. I think in the TV adaptations or in the animations, they kind of made him a little bit more, they kind of nerfed him out, you know, round off his edges. But he is quite spiky, even in the comics. Not as much as Wolverine, Logan and shit, but definitely of that kind of level. So it's good to see that. And I was happy that they kind of depicted him in the right way possible. So I was really happy to see that. But so far, not been enjoying it the most. Let's see how it kind of plays out going forward. Big up Young Old Vibes. Have you seen Ripperverse by Eric July? No, I haven't actually. Heard good things about it though. He is on a lot of the shows I sometimes watch. I've stopped watching them as much now. All those guys that do like content about how woke Hollywood is and shit. I used to watch a lot of those kind of guys. But after a while, you know, they just complain about fucking everything. It kind of got a bit boring. Even Friday Night Tights. I used to fucking love that. I don't really watch it anymore now as well because it's just like one long stream of them hating on absolutely everything. So I couldn't really put up with it anymore. But I do like a lot of those dudes. Nerdrotic, Geeks and Gamers. Him. Who's the other guy? What's the other guy called again? As V something. He's quite cool as well. So I'll definitely check it out. I'll definitely check it out. Next on the list. We have this interesting video. Interesting video that I wanted to highlight regarding this young lady and her experience with the one and the only Naomi Campbell. This person's name, they're an influencer online, African-based one called Elissa Majibo. This video came out a while ago, but I didn't really cover it, so I want to cover it now. So please forgive me if you've seen this already. But she basically details her experience meeting Naomi Campbell very early on in her career, and how Naomi Campbell kind of blocked her, kind of hated on her, and kind of negatively affected her career when she was coming up in the scene. So let's play this clip and you can see her, you can hear her account of what happened. And if you watch the video, you also laugh at how much fucking oil, how much moisturizer, and how much stuff she applies to her body during the process of this video. It's pretty funny. I quite like it. Let's check it out.
Talk about Naomi Campbell. Talk about Naomi Campbell. There's no me. Naomi, your mentor. Relax. Relax. I'm here to tell you today what happened. So, in December 2021, in December of 2020, Naomi was coming to Nairobi to do some shopping. She was on holiday, but on a remote place. So she was in Nairobi doing shopping. And I texted her and she told me she's in Nairobi. So I was so excited to meet her. She was the first celebrity I was ever going to meet. Guys, I was through the roof. She texted me. She was like, hey, I'm here. So she texted me the location. I went directly. I went with my brother. So my brother and I, we met her, we did some shopping. And as we're shopping, she's like, oh, you know, the plane that's taking us back actually has a few, couple more seats. Do you and your brother want to join us on holiday? Hell yes. So I was like, oh, that'll be so lovely. But I texted my dad. I said, hey, get the car ready. I'm coming to the house. We are going to the airport in an hour to meet Naomi Campbell so she can take me on vacation. So we go on vacation. We had a very nice vacation. Naomi took care of me the whole entire time. We were staying on the beach or doing this, and then like this, that, eating, just having fun, you know, what people do on vacation. And this one time we were on the beach, Naomi was like, oh, you know, we should do a documentary, a film about you living in Kenya. And I was like, oh yeah, that's fantastic. She introduced me to a couple of people in Hollywood. It was so lovely. So a couple of people she was on vacation with were coming to Nairobi after the vacation. They were staying at the Kempinski. So I went to see them at the Kempinski when the whole thing was over. So I went, I sat down with them, I was talking to one of them, and one of them was like, oh, it's so, like, how did you meet Naomi? And I was like, oh no, I texted her on Instagram, blah blah. And she's like, oh yeah, she told us, like, she made you and she built you and she made your career. And I was like, what? No, that's not what happened. And I was like, you mean, like, helped me and, like, promoted me? And she was like, no, like, what you have is because of her. And I was like, oh yeah, no, that didn't happen. It is very important you remember that part later. Okay.
Time goes by.
March 2022. We have jumped into March 2022. I get a phone call. My phone is ringing. Naomi Campbell. Oh, so I pick up, I'm like, hey sis, like, how are you? How are you doing? And she's like, Elsa, how dare you? Oh! So I'm in shock, right? I'm in shock. I don't know what's going on. So let me tell you what happened, the context of this phone call. So I had just finished the previous year, I had done a documentary on my life, about bullying, about growing up with colorism, all these things, about comedy, where I fell in love with comedy. So the film was debuting at Tribeca Film Festival, and someone from Tribeca asked Naomi if she's coming, and Naomi thought the film was the film she had suggested to me on the beach about me leaving Kenya. So I was like, no, that's not what it's about. I tried explaining to her, and then she was like, I'll sue you for the rights of this movie, and you know I'll win, right? So I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm like, this is crazy. I'm telling you, it's not about that. So I tell her, let me call you tomorrow. And she asked me, like, why didn't you tell me when I told you at the beach? And I was like, you're Naomi Campbell. You know, like, I was starstruck. Like, it took me very long to, like, process that moment. And I was like, I'll call you tomorrow. So the next day I had a flight. The flight I was taking from Botswana to Ghana, where I met that guy, actually, that's the time I was taking that flight. So I was supposed to call her the next day, but it was a 22-hour flight, and in Ethiopia, there was no service, so I couldn't call her. So I called her the day after, immediately I landed in Ghana. So she's the first person I called. I'm like, hey, blah, blah, like, are you free to talk? And she tells me, you were supposed to call me tomorrow. You were supposed to call me yesterday. You didn't call me yesterday, which she was very right about. And she said, I have the Met Gala. And she was like, this is the last time I'm speaking to you. Have a nice life. And she hung up. Ooh. Which I was like, I was very saddened by the situation, right? But I was like, if that's how she truly feels, because I respect people's space. So I was like, if that's how she truly feels, fine, it's okay. So I let it go. So after that, like, a few months, things started going very badly for me. Things started going haywire. And I thought it was because of the situation, let me not lie. But I was like, you know, also it can be sure. So I was like, let me go. Because also having someone like Naomi Campbell not liking you in the industry is not a good thing. So I went to her, I apologized. I'd already apologized when the situation had happened, but I went and I apologized again and again. I started calling her, I started texting her. And then one day she just texted me and she was like, stop calling me. I have a child to take care of. So after that, I just said, okay, there's nothing I can do about it. I started drinking. That's why I even quit alcohol. I started drinking.
Jesus Christ.
I started drinking a lot. Yeah. And then, because I wasn't sure why things were going so wrong, and I couldn't put my finger on it. And then a few months later, I met Edward Enifo at a party, and Edward Enifo is one of, oh my goodness, he's one of the people I adore the most. So I was like, oh my goodness, that's Edward. I have to go say hi. So I go, I say, I'm like, hey, Edward, I'm such a big fan. And he looks at me, He's like, I know you. And then he said something that made me think the situation with Naomi was causing like some of the trials and tribulations I was currently going through. So I was like, you know what? I need to fix this. So I went to one of our mutual friends and I was like, hey, please, can you tell Naomi? Because I knew they were going on holiday together. So I was like, hey, can you please tell Naomi to text me? And she was like, yeah, I'll make sure and blah, blah. So a couple of days went by and then Naomi finally texted me and she was like, yeah, I let that go a long time ago. I'm not one to hold a grudge. She sent me a very lovely text. She said, Happy New Year. So after that happened, this was the new year, 2023. So after that happened, every single step I made, every single move I made, I told Naomi. Every single thing I did, I told Naomi. I would breathe. I tell Naomi whether she would reply or not. I would send her a message because I didn't want what happened to happen again. And after some time, after a few weeks, I called my mom and I was like, this isn't normal. This doesn't feel healthy. It doesn't feel too nice. There's nothing healthy or normal about this. And I was like, I don't want to be in a situation like this. So after that, I just decided it is healthier for me to completely remove myself from the situation mm-hmm. and get myself out. And you remember earlier when I said my friends said the ones Naomi had introduced me to, when they said, oh, Naomi had made you. You remember when I say that? So I just want to acknowledge that and say that even through all this, right, even through everything that happened, first of all, number one, obviously I played a part in it because I am part of the story. In any situation you are in, you play a part, you play a role. And I have my role, and I apologize for my role. And something else, when she said she made me, I'm not going to speak on that, but I will say that Naomi did give me a lot of credibility, especially when I first entered the industry. She gave me a lot of credibility. And that's not something that I can just say, oh, you know, this happened, and Naomi, blah, blah. I can't say that. She did hold me up high, and she introduced me to a lot of people. She made me feel special. Mm-hmm. She did a lot of things for me. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say she made me, but she did play a big role in a lot of the things.
So in general, just to kind of round this up, because she's going on for a while here, it's an interesting story, I thought, to kind of cover, because in essence, she's talking about Naomi Campbell maybe playing a role in blocking some of her opportunities. She met Naomi Campbell really early in her career, and the co-sign of Naomi Campbell, the introductions, the doors that she was able to open, was able to kind of give her a bit of a push in her career early on. She was still doing her own thing, but obviously that co-sign kind of helped. And then one time she was hanging out, oh, big up Al, appreciate you.
Danu. That's Mortal Kombat.
Yeah, exactly. Big up Al, appreciate you, brother. So I guess what she's basically trying to say is that at some point during that relationship, one of Naomi Campbell's friends or associates came up to him and said, oh shit, you're that girl that Naomi Campbell put on. You're that girl that she's responsible for actually that platforming, and she gave you all these opportunities, blah, blah, blah. And I guess in that situation, what this proves is that this newer generation of kids, or maybe this new crop of like social media stars and shit, because they're incredibly successful when they're really young and very quickly, they sometimes don't feel like they have to kiss the ring, play the political game, or appease people, or kiss ass the way that maybe my generation would have. I feel like if somebody that was maybe from my generation was in that similar situation, they would have definitely acquiesced and just lied and be like, oh my God, Naomi, she's amazing. She gave me everything. She actually gave me my first gig. She introduced me to my first agent. People from my generation would have probably gone overboard to make it very clear that yes, Naomi is responsible for it, because you want to make a good impression on her friends, and you always want to always kind of like make, what's that, I think it's a law in 48 laws of power about never outshining the master, right? And always kind of being a little bit, what's that word called, always kind of making yourself smaller in their presence. So when her name is mentioned, instead of you standing up and thinking, no, I'm just as big as her, because I feel like nowadays there are probably girls on TikTok, probably girls on fucking Instagram who probably think they are way bigger deals than Naomi Campbell. There's probably some girls in fashion right now who are under 25 who probably don't even know who Naomi Campbell is. Legitimately, they have no idea who the fuck she is. So if they get a bit of fame, if they get a bit of hype, if people start to like them for who they are and what they present online, they could legitimately think, yeah, I'm bigger than Naomi Campbell. I don't need to acquiesce to her. I don't need to kiss her ring. I need to lick her ass. So if somebody ever come up to her and said, hey, Kate Moss made you, Naomi Campbell made you, they'd like be disgusted. Like, how dare you? I did this myself. I'm the one who took all the pictures. I was the one up late, you know, reordering my fucking feed, changing captions and shit. They would actually be legitimately offended. But I think in that situation, you have to just play the game. You have to know when and when to kind of turn that thing on and off, even if you have the maximum amount of clout. Because I think what she's basically trying to say is that she was already on her way back then. She didn't really need Naomi Campbell. Naomi Campbell obviously helped to kind of, you know, grease some palms, open some doors, you know, just be somebody to stand and next. Like, I'm sure in fashion, in, you know, entertainment industry, if you walk in a room with Naomi Campbell, you're going to be in a better place when you leave that room at the end of the night. We all know that to be true. But if you're already doing your own thing, maybe you don't want to be associated with her because you want to do your own thing. Or maybe you're not going to be fully kind of in her debt because you're doing your own thing. But I think in that situation, she should have just played her role and been very, what's that point called? And been very kind of clear, even if it was false, even if it was a lie, that yes, Naomi Campbell was responsible for her success and she was internally grateful and she's just eager to meet new people. And who knows, that one conversation would have led to other conversations that could have led to a deal. It's all kind of up in the air. Now, that doesn't excuse Naomi Campbell's actions and how she kind of treated her. Being a grown-ass woman and treating a girl in her 20s like this and almost kind of bullying her in a way and humiliating her and making her grovel and beg for you for your forgiveness and call you a million times and go through intermediaries and all this sort of shit, that's very lame. For a grown-ass woman to do it's very lame. I guess the only excuse for that would be Naomi Campbell is a model. She's in that fashion industry. In that fashion industry, people aren't really there born ages. You know, people kind of have a weird state of like arrested development. So people probably stop kind of growing up or maturing maybe at the age of like 25. So maybe she actually feels like she's 27, Naomi Campbell. So she feels like she can act like that with this girl because she doesn't actually see herself as like a 60-plus-year-old woman or whatever she is, right? So that might maybe explain why she acted that way. But obviously, it's not an excuse. But I think in this situation, if that was me, I would have just acquiesced and just kind of, you know, licked her ass for the sake of it, just to keep the peace. But I do think this is a very unique situation for this new generation because there are kids coming up who are so famous. I think we saw already with the Kai Cenat v Kanye beef. Kai Cenat got into a bit of a back and forth with Kanye because he got some Yeezy merch sent to him and it didn't fit right and he was upset about it. Kanye kind of, you know, called him out online and then Kai Cenat clapped back at him. And then Kanye's manager, this guy called John Monopoly, got involved. And this John Monopoly guy, from what he says and from the little research I've done on him, he's clearly like a bigwig in the industry. He's allegedly the brother of Don C, who's associated with Kanye, old school Chicago promoter, A&R manager type dude. So he's very much, you know, a part of hip hop history in some sense. But you have to be a certain age to know who the fuck he is, right? I didn't even know fucking Kanye had a manager in the first place. So the fact that he's got a manager and his name John Monopoly, I have no fucking idea. But there was a clear disconnect you can see on the phone call when they were talking because I think that John Monopoly guy was trying to flex on Kai Cenat with his name and with his status. But Kai doesn't know him from a fucking lick of paint. And you even saw it very clearly when John Monopoly mentioned, what you call it, Chris Lighty from Violator Recordings, right? Or Violator fucking A&R, that, you know, group that fucking 50 was signed to back in the day. And Kai Cenat had no idea about Violator, had no idea about Chris Lighty, zero. He probably barely knows some 50 Cent tunes. So I think that goes to show that this new generation of kids are just so famous, so clouted up, that they don't actually need to kiss the ring. They don't actually need to appease the gatekeepers to actually get a career, to kind of get anywhere in the industry. And that does create some weird friction because I'm assuming the gatekeepers and the old heads want to be recognized and want to be seen as some people who have something, I don't know, whatever, from these young cats. But these young cats also don't see them as anything and don't really respect them, especially if they're going to come at them in that way. But I do think there should be like a little balancing act in between to kind of make those things work. But I do love the fact that she's got this ongoing troll where she applies copious. And when I mean copious, I mean copious amounts of moisturizer, body butter, body gel, body shine, like loads of, I think that little roll-on thing that she had applying on her shoulder, I'd actually like to get that. She had this kind of roll-on thing she applied on her shoulders and she put it in the middle of her chest. It kind of looked like some sort of like body sheen. I'd actually like to wear that, I'm not going to lie. If I was going to a techno club and I had my little vest on, I'd actually like to have my arms out, like shiny fucking shining as I'm in a club. I actually didn't mind that. But I do think it's a bit of a troll. It might not be a troll. She might just actually like moisturizer, because one of the good things I liked, if you looked at some of her bottles that she was pouring into her hands, there was some fucking moisturizer bottles that were legitimately looked like they were about to finish. So she clearly does use moisturizer, is very much into skincare, is very much into, you know, her appearance and her fucking, she's even putting on mad amounts of fucking perfume and fragrance and shit. And she's doing a TikTok video. Do you know what I mean? We can't even smell her. And she's applying mad amounts of fucking, you know, fragrance and eau de toilette and shit. So I fucking love it. I really love it. I think it's fucking amazing. Especially someone like myself. As you guys know from my streams, I love to look shiny. I fucking love looking shiny. I love looking like I'm dripping, like I'm wet. But sometimes it's a bad thing because I also sweat a lot. So it can sometimes mix in and it can create this really, you know, what's the thing called? Condensed, combustion-esque. You know, the side of a central line kind of vibe face going on. But I do like the fact that she has all that sheen going, all that fucking body butter and, you know, oils and gels and body mist and shit. Because I think she had a bit of that. So I think I saw some body mist there as well. If you know, you know about the body mist vibe out there. So big up her. Enjoy the fucking breakdown. And I do think it's quite cool to see these young kids who are coming up in the industry and don't need these OG and old heads to get forward. But I do think there should be a kind of a balancing act that you play where you kiss the ring for the sake of peace in the Middle East in that moment. And also for the sake of just maybe getting you another free deal here and there and waxing someone's ego. And then there's also the importance of like saying, no, this person was responsible for my success. This person wasn't, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, there is a balance that you can kind of do in the middle there to make that kind of work. So big up her. Big up that young lady. Big up that young lady called Elsa Majibo. Elsa Majibo. Appreciate her. Appreciate her. Yo, big up Fashion Roman. Wow, Guan. Hope you're good, brother. Oh, yeah, she's a lotion girl. Okay, cool. Yeah, I like her, man. I'm actually going to start following her on TikTok. I don't actually use TikTok that much, but I'm going to start following her. That's her actual name. If you guys want to follow her on TikTok, that's her name there. Her name is Elsa Majibo. I'm assuming she's probably Kenyan or something, so she keeps talking about Kenya. But she's an influencer, I guess, a comedian as well, from what I've been able to understand. And yeah, she put some fits out there as well, which I like. Oh, she's actually on Twitter too. I'm pretty sure I follow her on Twitter. What am I talking about? She put some fits out on Twitter. Her fits on Twitter, I'm not going to lie, I don't really like the majority of them. I think she usually looks like a mess. But because her body is tea, as people like to say on social media, it kind of just looks great. I think she's a perfect example of sometimes why it's really important as a person to sometimes focus on your body and your personal hygiene and how you just look in clothes as opposed to your wardrobe and your style and shit. Because I don't think her personal style is that great. She has a lot of misses in some of her looks. But because her body looks the way it doesn't really matter. Do you know what I mean? It really doesn't. She can wear legitimately a plastic bag and it's going to look quote-unquote good on her because her body is tea, as Drake would say. Her body is tea, as Drake would blood clot say. Moving on from girls that have tea bodies. Can we talk about girls on social media? I don't know how to navigate social media. So I was watching this documentary on Netflix. I'm not too sure if you guys have watched it, called Can I Tell You a Secret? And I have to recommend it to everybody out there, especially those of you who are women in my fan base. All my women viewers, all my women listeners, all my women kind of fans, whatever you are in between, you have to watch this documentary called Can I Tell You a Secret on Netflix. It's basically about this guy from the UK, unfortunately, who was the first guy to be convicted for cyberstalking online. And he essentially, I think he went in for like 7 years, something. I've got his fucking name. But essentially, he was living in this small town somewhere in England. And he basically ended up terrorizing all these girls that he went to school with. obviously, they didn't know at the time that he was an old school friend because he did it much later on in their lives. But he absolutely terrorized them online, especially on Facebook. He terrorized these people. And this was early on the times of social media when a lot of us were quite naive, when a lot of us used to put our entire lives on there. Because I know for myself, I can speak from my own account, you know, and again, it's probably, you know, it doesn't really matter with me being a guy. I'm probably not going to put my life in danger. But I honestly think in my case, I was very much naive to social. No, I wasn't naive. I went to social media head first. I would post literally everything I did by the minute, to the minute. It was basically a play-by-play of what I was doing on any given day. And obviously, over time, I kind of got bored of doing that. And now I basically got out of my way never to give an indication of where I'm at, what I'm doing in that particular moment. Sometimes I'll go to the gym like hours before, then post a clip at that time to make it look like I went then, just to kind of mess up my fucking timeline. So it's all kind of different. But back then, everybody did that. And I guess because everybody kind of did a play-by-play 24-hour coverage of their lives, he took advantage of it and he was able to get inside these people's lives, especially these young girls. And what he did that was really kind of mean and really cruel is that sometimes he would play into the inner politics, the inner beef, whatever that was going on within that crew already, that he might have already have known about or heard about from back in the day because it was a small town, or something he just kind of surmised from keeping an eye on people who like certain things, people who comment on certain things. So he'd go on this one particular girl's post, I think it's this one in particular, and he basically started messaging one of her friends but posing as her boyfriend, right? And then that girl would then be a little bit uncomfortable with her friend boyfriend texting her that way, then the boyfriend would be like, it's not really me. But then in the process of them talking, she might have said some stuff disparagingly about her friend that then would make their relationship a bit weird, to the point where I think this particular girl on the cover of the documentary, her boyfriend actually ended up breaking up with her because of all the drama that was going on with this guy stalking and pretending to be him, pretending to be some of her friends. And the really crazy thing, again, don't judge me for this, one of the things that really kind of boggled my mind, when they went to go arrest him at his house, according to the reconstruction of the arrest on the documentary, because obviously we don't see actual real footage of it, when they went to go seize his electronics, you know what he had? He had some like shitty tablet, not like an iPad, whatever brand, like an Alcatel, whatever, and some Android phone. He was terrorizing thousands of girls online with all these different aliases and identities, all with just one tablet and one Android phone. I was honestly, legitimately blown away by that. I thought they would go in and see like a goon room, see like seven monitors on the wall, maybe see a post-it board with like string tying things together. He was able to keep up all those passwords, all those IDs, all those conversation threads, all of it in his head, and then one tablet and a fucking smartphone. Crazy, crazy, crazy shit. But in the end, you know how they found out about him, and they kind of was able to kind of rumble him and get him? He fucked up one day and he logged onto one of the accounts that he had, a fake account, and he went live on Instagram quickly, like by accident. But then somebody was online when he did that, saw it, and saw him on the camera. He tried to quickly cover his camera, but it was too late. And they instantly recognized him as, oh, that's that boy from school, the weirdo kid that no one spoke to. Because I think he had autism and shit. He was a little bit socially awkward and whatever, and a bit of an outcast. So he was able to kind of find out it was him. And obviously through some other investigation, other bits of, you know, whatever came through, they was eventually able to arrest him. But if he didn't make that mistake of going live on Instagram, there's a possibility he might have never been found, because of how intricate he was kind of weaving all these fucking crazy webs. Part of me, when I was watching the documentary, I was also kind of a little bit like judging the girls. I was almost like, how did these girls be so stupid? How can they be so naive to put so much of their information up there, to be so... Because I think a lot of them also, they had this thing. I think that's the title of the documentary, Can I Tell You a Secret? That's how he starts these conversations. He'll be like, hey, chick. He'll pretend to be like a girl and use like, you know, fucking girl vernacular, like hun, babe, all this sort of stuff, like certain exes. And then he'll say, can I tell you a secret? And then that secret will usually be some nonsense to kind of get into their heads about their boyfriends, about their sisters, whatever it may be. And one of the things I was watching, and I was watching this documentary, I was sitting there thinking, these girls are super dumb. Like, why are they entertaining this guy's conversation? They have no idea who this person is. They're pretending to be somebody else, No, sorry. They have no idea this person who they're talking to is who they're talking to, but they're just entertaining the conversation because it looks like, because I guess when he would text these girls, he'd create a fake profile and make it look like a, you know, a normal girl, like some regular girl from like a nearby town that had her own life with a popping in. Like he'd kind of build up a really kind of almost looking legit profile with actual legit looking pictures, legit looking comments. Like he did the graft, but still the girls would entertain these random cold DMs from him posing as these girls. And I thought it was really dumb and naive and I almost judged the girls for it. Then as the documentary went on, I began to feel bad for them because I was like, you know what? It's not fair that they should have to change the way they act on social media, that they should have to kind of curtail or pull back how much they share because there's guys that exist. You should be free to post everything that you do from the time that you piss, shit, have breakfast, talk to your partner, hang out with your kids. You can do whatever you want. Display your entire fucking life on social media if you so please. That doesn't mean because you do that, people should then be allowed to take that information and, you know, do wrong by you or do bad by you or do evil shit to you or fuck up your life or fuck your relationship. That isn't not fair. That's obviously not cool, as Tom Segura would say. And that is the reason why he was able to go down for so many years. But at the end, when I did finish it, I really did feel bad for every single woman involved because you could tell their relationship with social media, they're just, you know, them as a person had become completely changed from that day onwards. They were never the same. Even though the guy got convicted and the problem's kind of technically gone away, you can tell that these women have all been fundamentally changed ever since then. I think one lady in the documentary, actually, this lady on the poster, her boyfriend broke up with her. Another one, if I'm not mistaken, her wedding got cancelled because of all the drama that guy was causing. Like, he caused some actual legitimate havoc in these people's actual real lives. So I really do recommend you check it out. It's called Can I Tell You a Secret? It's about this guy who basically was able to clone crazy amounts of fucking accounts. I'm actually going to read the synopsis for you here so you can see what I'm talking about because I think I'm not really getting it the right way here. So let me read you to the fucking synopsis here. The synopsis says, yeah, so I'll actually read the fucking review on Guardian so you can see what it actually says. The review on the Guardian is as follows. Let me read the article in The Guardian. There needs to be, I've decided, a subdivision of categories within the proliferation of offerings under the genre true crime documentary. Foremost among them needs to be one called What Happens When Only Women Are in Danger. This admittedly would cover a large portion of genre, but then I would like some action on the issue of social, cultural, legal, police dismissal of, and contempt of women's vulnerabilities. Into this category would fall Can I Tell You a Secret? The latest true crime offering from the leader of the pack, Netflix, and the first it has made with Louis Theroux's Mindhouse production company and association with The Guardian. In the story of the cyberstalker Matthew Hardy, that's the guy that got that was stalking everybody, who terrorized multiple women over many years. The case was the first covered in depth in G2 by Siren Kale, then via a 6-part Guardian podcast series in 2002, the year Hardy received the longest sentence handed down on the UK for stalking, which is 9 years. He got 9 years. 9 fucking years for that. The 2-part documentary concentrates on 3 of the many women who Hardy targeted, Abby, Zoe, and Leah, whose 700 pages of meticulous records of the poisonous communications with her and her family and colleagues would eventually help enable charges against them. Were all attractive, happy, confident young women with strong online presences. That's a really good point. That's the thing that's really heartbreaking at the end of it. That's the really heartbreaking thing at the end of it. They were all attractive, happy, confident young women with strong online presences. And by the end, they were all fucking, they all kind of wilted. They all kind of, even when they're sitting talking, they're all kind of within their own shell. They're like a shadow of their former selves, you would imagine. It's really kind of sad to see how much havoc he was able to cause just from not even being in there, not even being close to them physically or not even touching them physically, just from all from online shit and social media. It's fucking wild. It continues. When they started receiving messages from a confiding stranger, apparently female, whose gambit was often the line that gives the series a title. Generally, within the few exchanges, Abby et al. Would grow suspicious, investigate the profile of the messenger, and withdraw from the communication. This is when the harassment will begin. Using fake profiles, posing as a woman to send sexual content to the fathers of their friends. Yeah, that was a really heartbreaking one. One of the girls, this guy ended up sending... Yeah, one of the girls... Crazy, right? One of the girls was doing OnlyFans on the side or something, but she wasn't sure that she was going to do it. She took the pictures, but she wasn't sure if she was going to open an OnlyFans account. Somehow, this fucking guy got a hold of those pictures that weren't online yet by contacting the photographer, posing as her. Like, he did some crazy thing. He gets a hold of these pictures. Then he gets those pictures and then starts to flirt with one of her friend's dads. And in that flirting conversation, he sends the pictures of that girl's OnlyFans to him as like, hey, let's exchange nudes. Can you imagine how embarrassing that must have been for the dad, thinking he's talking to one of his daughter's friends when actually he's talking to this guy? Honestly, I shouldn't laugh, but that bit was, it blew my mind. That guy is a fucking sicko. He's a fucking sicko. Anyway, continues. Apparently, female whose gambit was often the line that gives a series a title. Generally, within a few messages, Abby et al. Would grow suspicious, investigate the profile of the messengers, and withdraw from communication. This is when the harassment would begin, using fake profiles, posing as women who sent extra sexual content to fathers of their friends, for example, or posing as people the women had met on holiday in order to message their boyfriends, start rumors, and sow division. Meanwhile, the direct contact between Hardy and his targets became increasingly vicious and threatening. This girl obviously is the real fucking MVP of the series. This young lady called Leah. She's the one who was able, I think her wedding got ruined off the back of him fucking doing this nonsense. So she took it all in her own hands and decided to collate all this evidence because the police also at the time weren't taking it seriously. And because she works as like a paralegal or something, she has an incredibly organized administrative brain. So she legitimately put together a dossier, like a massive file that was color coded, dated, chronological, all like fucking crazy, that she gave to the police. And that legitimately was one of the bases that framed the whole entire case. Without that document, maybe the case wouldn't have been able to be prosecuted. So she played a vital role because she was able to collect all that information, screenshots and stuff that she was printing off at work and putting into this massive fucking 700 page fucking folder. So big up her. But I really recommend you check it out. It's a fucking crazy, crazy documentary. The title is Can I Tell You a Secret? It's available on Netflix. And I think if you watch it, especially as a cisgendered male like myself, you definitely will feel a lot more sympathy for our fellow women and sisters out there who have to navigate social media with the threat of, or with the, you know, lingering feeling that you never know who you're talking to online. Could be some weirdo who's trying to sow division between you and your friends or try and make your life a fucking living hell. Absolutely horrific, but really recommend you check it out. Definitely a good insight to keep an eye out on what to look for when people are trying to creep on you and ask you weird questions on your DMs. Really good series. It's called, sorry, documentary called Can I Tell You a Secret? Available on Netflix now. Check it out. Check it out. Next on the list. Let's talk about this. So, I've been very curious because there was not a lot of news on this for a while, I felt like. And now we suddenly got some news and it suddenly has dropped. And that was Heron Preston's collection with H&M. So Heron Preston was hired by H&M to be, if I'm not mistaken, was it a menswear advisor initially? Was that the initial role? I think that's what the initial role was. Let's see. Heron Preston, H&M hire. I'm not sure what his actual legit role was. Let me see what it's before I continue with this, because I think that's important to kind of surmise here. Yeah, so Heron Preston will act as consultant for H&M menswear line and mentor new talent. The designer who 2010 co-founded streetwear brand Bintrill with the late off-white designer Virgil will also design a seasonal capsule collection for H&M, expected to launch in 2012. So he's basically like a, you know, an advisor, for lack of a better term. You'd imagine if he does a good job, they might give him a permanent role, because I feel like, oddly enough, his aesthetic, his sensibilities, his style, his design philosophy kind of matches up a lot to what H&M kind of does. It's almost very much in line with H&M. It's actually a really good appointment, I would say. More so than him taking a job at like a high fashion, like a fashion house somewhere. I don't think that would really work too well. I don't really think he has the range. He has the skills. Again, as much as I love the guy, he doesn't really have the range, expertise, or maybe the product offerings to really take those type of jobs to the next level. But when it means H&M, and when it means to kind of like, you know, perfecting like wardrobe staples, unisex in terms of like bombers, hoodies, jeans, t-shirts, long sleeves, caps and shit, he's going to smash it. So this is what I've seen online. So when you go on H&M main website, you've got this H2 little logo or little video that kind of pops up on here. I love the use of the models and all the stuff that they're wearing here. It kind of gives you a feel of like some sort of metropolitan street somewhere. Obviously, it's a studio. There is a lot of like, you know, there is a lot of kind of blending of different pieces worn on men and women, and there's no clear delineation between it being for men or women. So it clearly is a brand or a collection that's been steered more towards the direction of it being unisex. Loads of big baggy boxy fits that are very similar to what you'd expect from Heron Preston on his mainline. There isn't a lot of stuff that you would see on his mainline apart from maybe a shirt like this. I don't really see a lot of that bright orange color that he's usually kind of known for in his mainline. And also, but you get the feeling a lot of it's going to be staples like bomber jackets, big pants, a lot of nice shirts and shit that a lot of people are going to be clearly into. So if we actually take a close look at the collection, I actually think, I'm not going to lie, I legitimately think this might be one of the best things he's done in a fucking long time. And the really good thing about this is that I've always thought Heron Preston clothing overall, pricing wise, is a little bit overpriced for what it is, given where it sits on the fucking shop floor, especially in big, you know, stores and shit and online retailers, considering the other luxury brands that you could buy in a similar price range. I've always thought the price range of actual, you know, mainline Heron Preston has always been a little bit too much for me personally. But I'm also understanding there's not many brands out there that do what Heron Preston does. His aesthetic, although it can be a little bit repetitive, is very much him. It's very much clear what he does. You can spot it from a mile away. And the people that rock it fucking love that shit. But I do love the fact that he's been able to synthesize all that shit into the H&M collection. One of the things that I love that stands out the most is this reversible bomber jacket. It comes in black. And the reversible comes in this nice burgundy color and also the classic sort of like MA1 bomber orange. If I was going to choose a color to pick, I would maybe at a stretch pick the orange just because it's a classic one, but I think the maroon blood orange or the burgundy color might be the one to actually pick, because when you flip that around, you know, you'd imagine there's not many people that go out there and purposely, because the good thing about reversible jackets is that you got the option of it being reversible, and you should probably pick a color that you probably would never buy if it was just like a jacket that wasn't reversible. And I think most people, if they're buying a bomber, they'd probably buy a black one. They wouldn't buy a maroon, burgundy, red wine type of color. So I really do like these. I like the fucking badges on it. I love the cut. I love the fact that it kind of seems like, maybe it's the styling of how it's been photographed, but it looks like it's been cut like a circle. So the cut on this is really good. It kind of looks like a circle, and it kind of looks like it's going to cut and it kind of crops up really short. I love the fact that it doesn't bunch up at the bottom, because I've got a couple of bombers that are cut short, but unfortunately they bunch up really hard here towards the bottom, and it creates this unnecessary kind of penis thing in the front, which I fucking hate. If I had to swap it, I would say if I could get the maroon jacket to also have these kind of go faster flames on the side of the sleeves, I'd love that. But obviously that go faster flame thing, and I think that logo on the back only exists on the one with the orange. If you want the maroon one, you're not going to get the go faster stripes. You're just going to get this kind of tonal design type of thing going on there. This canvas jacket with H2 Industries ink on the back, I'm not really too fan of it. It looks a little bit too much like Prison Break type shit. That's not really for me. The denim jacket cut is a bit too baggy for me. I probably wouldn't wear that. I like the sweatpants. I like this boxy shirt. I'd probably wear the fuck out of that boxy shirt. That was very versatile and easy to wear. And at $37.99, that's fucking a no-brainer. The bomber jacket, even at $230, I think is a good price. Because in my opinion, I'm not too sure if you guys agree, but I think when it comes to high street stuff, H&M quality is really good. H&M quality is like, odd, it's like surprisingly good. It's similar to like Urban Outfitters. Urban Outfitters mainline or Urban Outfitters in-store stuff. I think I'm actually wearing one Urban Outfitters shirt actually now at the moment. It's almost like a half, you know, long sleeve shirty thing, whatever. The quality is actually pretty decent. It washes very well. It fits very well. There's always big boxy cuts. Obviously, these new, I call them like Gen Z cuts, right? Everyone's got these big boxy, oversized type of cuts things. They actually look pretty decent. So I'm actually not that bothered about spending $230 on a bomber jacket page because I think it'll actually work or last quite long. You got these sweatpants. These nice boxy sweatpants that you're seeing a lot of people wear now. The entire Yeezy collection has been based off of this sweatpant, which is kind of, I think, a copy or the precursor to this will probably be the Rick Owens Berlin pant. If you know, you know about that pant, right, from back in the day, the Rick Owens Berlin pant, that sweat pant has been a legendary one. And there's also a really big, there's also a bigger version. I'm not too sure what that one is actually called. I actually had one of those ones. It's really massive. It's a sweatpant. It's because the Berlin one's a little bit more of a, I guess, a straight cut fit. And then there's another one that's really fucking baggy and exaggerated. But that sweatpant look with the non-elasticated hem at the bottom, I love. Nice and straight, nice and flat. That's pretty decent. The sweat shorts are also good. Reversible hoodie, I don't really give a fuck about. The t-shirt, I love. Both of the t-shirts, you know, you got this nice over-dyed, effect here on the top. Nice print there on the back. Very Y2K style. Maybe again, maybe this stuff isn't going to have the best shelf life aesthetically. It's very much in this current era generation, but I do like it regardless of what it is. I really, really like this top. This is one of my favorite tops here. This printed jersey top where you've got this long sleeve t-shirt, boxy feel. That's also got this printed mesh, what would you call it? Basketball top thing that has H2 Sport on the front. I fucking love that. I'm not going to lie. I really do love this top. It kind of reminds me of this old a New York thing t-shirt I had. I had all three of them. Whereas a New York thing t-shirt back when Aaron Bondaroff was still the founder of it or still involved in it. The former sort of like model for Supreme and manager and shit and all that stuff before he got cancelled, unfortunately. He made these really cool shirts that I used to have where it was like a netting. So it kind of like was a basketball, it was like a string vest that was printed on a t-shirt. So I had it in black, had it in white, had it in yellow. I fucking love that shirt. I wore it into the fucking ground. It's probably, you know, somewhere underneath some ocean somewhere. I also love this layered t-shirt. This is also really cool, similar to what I'm currently wearing at the moment. But you've got this really nice kind of dragon motif here on the side. I'm not really too fond of the logo in the middle here. The Unity thing, I feel, is a little bit gay, but whatever. I also love this mesh t-shirt here that says Unity. This, I think that Unity phrase works a lot better on here. This top actually reminds me of the OG Heron Preston NASCAR top that he did back in the day with all the logos on it. I think this looks pretty cool. It almost looks a little bit motocross, a little bit NASCAR-y. I love it regardless. The jeans, double knee jeans, worker jeans, I'm over. I don't care. The logo jeans, I don't really fuck with. The pink shorts, I love. The white jeans, I love. I also love these. I know some of you won't like these, but I fucking love this. Bike chain bracelet and necklace. So it's a bike chain, as you would assume, with a carabiner harness or lock, but then it's covered in this like translucent sky blue kind of rubber plastic casing, I guess, to make sure it doesn't rub or scratch against your fucking neck. But it also provides another kind of color, another kind of design on the top of it, another kind of casing. I actually really like it. The bracelet is whatever. I'll probably say the necklace. It's more of like a, I guess, a choker design. And I guess if you wanted to, you could probably get it shortened if you want it. But I really do like that. Again, maybe most people won't. I like it. This bag I also love. This Canvas Weekend bag. Maybe 140 is a bit much for it. But I love the utility of it. It's off-white. It's got these nice big straps on it. Maybe it will stain a bit easy, especially with me. But it looks like you could fit quite a bunch of stuff in there and whatnot and get on with your travels. You've got some of the quote-unquote women's stuff here. Some bodysuits. Some corsets, which I don't really give a shit about. The bikini top shit looks pretty cool. But the rest of it, the main collection, I fucking love. I really do love the main collection. So I'm actually oddly surprised by how good it is. The majority of it I'll definitely wear. I think the price range is on point, and I think I'm interested to see how this relationship continues and how it kind of evolves, because they really did keep, I wouldn't say they kept down the wraps, but it kind of felt like maybe they kind of scrapped this whole thing because it was announced and then we didn't really hear anything in between. Maybe it's my fault because I'm not really on Instagram. I know Heron Preston uses Instagram a lot to kind of, you know, interact with his kind of community and shit. So maybe that's the reason why I didn't really see anything. But I do love the fact that now we're seeing it out, we're seeing what he's able to do with them, and maybe going forward we might see some more interesting cool things continue and this relationship evolve as the years progress. But so far, big up Heron Preston, big up this H2 collection. I love it. I think it looks flipping cool, and I think it looks flipping cool. Continuing on from that one, you know what else is oddly cool, and you guys won't believe it when I say this. You know what else is oddly cool? And you guys will not believe it when I say this. The Boiler Room collection. The Boiler Room Spring Summer 2024 collection is actually really fucking good. I don't know if they're purposely hiring specific designers from brands, or they're getting in kids who are trying to make a name for themselves, or they're purposely trying to steer the Boiler Room brand into being an overall all-encompassing brand, doesn't just focus on live stream DJ events, and it's actually a whole lifestyle company type of thing. And maybe they're going to come out with fucking drinks and other bits and bobs and furniture and whatever else coming forward. But regardless, whoever's doing the design work over there, whoever's doing the styling, whoever's doing the photography, whoever's doing the casting, you are doing an incredibly good job, because this shit looks really good. This stuff looks as good as the stuff I've seen from Stussy, the stuff I've seen from Supreme, the stuff I've seen from Hellstar, the stuff I've seen from Cortez, the stuff I've seen from fucking Awake, the stuff I've seen from Dime. Like, this is as good as all of those really established brands, streetwear brands that are really doing bits and pushing the fucking envelope. This Boiler Room collection is just as good, I'm not gonna lie. So this is the lookbook, and that features Boiler Room Spring Summer 2024. You got this nice vest top here, you got a nice bag, you've got this great t-shirt that says I'm bored already, I love it, in a nice fucking, I guess, Helvetica font. I'm not too sure if it is, don't kill me if it isn't. You got this really cool long sleeve print mesh shirt that features a picture, I guess, of some club somewhere, but it looks fucking beautiful, I'm not going to lie. I'd love to see them do something similar with the, imagine if Fold did something similar with that iconic picture of like how the blinds open in Fold when the sun's coming up in the morning. That would be fucking brilliant to have that kind of print on, 3D printed on a fucking mesh top somewhere. That would look fucking awesome as well. You got this bomber jacket. Like, look at this bomber jacket from Boiler Room. This bomber jacket is fucking fire. That legitimately would look good, you know, on most brands' lookbooks and shit. And I remember when I checked the site, it was sold out. So I'm not the only person that loves this shit, right? That I'm bored already t-shirt is available. I guess in women's, or the baby t-shirt is in white, and the regular t-shirt print is in blue. And let me check. And again, see, that's that Lausanne mess t-shirt. I guess Lausanne is like, isn't that Belgium? Lausanne, is it Belgium or Switzerland? I forgot, one of those countries. That shirt print, or that print, comes on a dress. It also comes in a long sleeve t-shirt, a t-shirt, and a vest top. And then the actual bomber jacket I wanted to show you guys, last time I checked, it was sold out. Yeah, there you go. See, that core MA1 in olive. I wasn't the only person that fucking liked it. That MA1 jacket is absolutely sold out. Look at it. But it's absolutely beautiful. You can see why people would be jumping on it. So clearly I'm not the only person that's been able to see that Boiler Room are making some great shit. You got this amazing olive green bomber jacket. It's kind of done in a vintage, I guess, parachute type of style bomber jacket, where you've got this nice gussets here on the edges that connect the sleeves. You got, again, a very short body. I love this flap that goes over the zip. I love how the elastication on the neckline kind of sits in there. And it's got a nice kind of vintage boxy shape. They've also got, interesting, they've got the logo on the outside there. I don't know if I like that, to be fair. I'm not going to lie. I don't really like that logo on the outside. I don't think Boiler Room has got the cachet just yet to have that. Because that logo hits different if it's like Dries, if it's Raph, if it's Rick, if it's Mew Mew. Well, do you know what I mean? Having a logo like that, like Issey Miyake, Comme des Garçons, that will hit a bit different. But having a logo on the outside of your jacket like that and it says Boiler Room, it's a little bit mad. A little bit mad. But, you know, they're trying to get there. And then you've also got a Boiler Room logo on the inside. You've got a nice pull zip there. I'm not too sure if they're Riri zippers or anything. Riri zippers or YKK. Okay, standard YKK zippers are not the most premium of zippers and shit, but, you know, they're starting. Nice elasticated cuffs there. Oh, you've also got an insulated inner. That's nice. You've got an insulated, almost thermal inner. A lot of people like this shit. I've seen a lot of people, especially in Central, wearing these insulated inners as like an actual layering piece over a jacket. Because I have a lot of these that go into my like parkas and shit that I just usually throw away or leave on the inside. But I've seen a lot of people kind of wear them on the outside of a jacket or over a shirt and shit as a layering piece. It's pretty cool. And there's also a nice little stash pocket on the inside there where you can stash all your drogas or your Bible or your condoms or your pens or your lighters or your rollies, whatever you want to put in there, lollipops, right, whatever you can put in that little stash pocket. But that fucking bomber is definitely one of the highlights of that collection. Going back to the lookbook, you've also got this nice utility vest, which is a quintessential thing that you see in most dance floors out there. And again, this funny thing is, I'm just thinking about it now, I think this Boiler Room collection or the ones I've seen so far, this is one part of a whole business that they do, right? Because you'd imagine looking at the website, they've got Boiler Room, they've got events that they do, events management, they do video production, then audio platforms in some respect, they sell stuff, and they also have a roving world tour production event type of thing going on, right? So these are all these different verticals that they're doing. So they're able to compete and make clothes of the level of some of the biggest streetwear brands out there. But they're also able to create really cool clubwear pieces that absolutely wipe the floor with core dedicated clubwear brands like Our Label Group, right? That brand, I think that's founded by, I forgot his fucking name, the DJ, but he's this guy that's got this label, and then he changed it into like a merch thing, and it's now a full fashion collection where he's got all these overpriced like techno wear stuff, whatever. And that stuff isn't that great. And I think what Boiler Room do is far better than that Our Label Group merch, clothing line, ready-to-wear collection that they actually have. If I'm not mistaken, Our Label presents their show during Milan Fashion Week. So Milan Men's Fashion Week, or maybe Paris, one of them two. But during a major fashion week, they actually present all that shit on the runway. And it's like overpriced sweats, overpriced parkas and whatever. Obviously, the styling and the lookbooks and the casting's great. They'll have fucking Sven from Berghain there. They'll have someone from fucking, you know, that fucking, I forgot the collective that he did, the fucking well-known DJ from Amsterdam and shit. They have all these amazing people walking the show, but the clothes are terrible. So it's quite good to see Boiler Room, despite all the shit they do, be able to outdo an actual specific clubwear brand by just dabbling in it. So this mesh utility vesting, if you've ever been to a techno club, you'll know that everybody has these sort of things. So that's fucking great. I love the lanyard little detail and the styling. And again, the styling's fucking banging as well. Big up this again, the stylist, whoever's in charge, you did a great job. Look at the little detail I just noticed there. They gave the model a little wristband as well. Do you know what I mean? Something that you'd get if you went to like a Boiler Room event or any type of rave event as well. So that's fucking cool. Actual real keys, probably covered in ketamine and any other fucking white substances and shit, which is quite cool to see. I love that little detail. The styling and photography is fucking amazing. This jacket or this kind of tracksuit look is really cool too. I haven't seen that actually tracksuit look on the actual website. That's really cool. That tracksuit look thing where it's got the fucking U zip on the front is really fucking cool. Where is it? I think that might be the pants for it, maybe. I'm not too sure, but I haven't actually seen that jacket. Where's that jacket? Let me see if the jacket is available here. I've not seen that here available just yet. Maybe they're drip feeding a lot of the stuff later, so we might see a lot of it later on down the line. See, they're selling everything from tape. They've got lanyards, they've got keychain holders, they've got socks. But okay, that jacket or that tracksuit look hasn't come out just yet. This is another one of my favorites. I really like that look there. This mesh jersey is already out. This football jersey type thing is nice. That t-shirt I don't think has dropped yet, with the kind of logo almost kind of vibrating. The big Boiler Room t-shirt is obviously a staple and an iconic t-shirt people would love. This jacket also is really cool. I think that's also sold out, if I'm not mistaken, with the zips all over it. That's a really cool one too. Oh no, it's not sold actually. That's a cargo jacket there. The cargo jacket in Antarctic. This is really cool. Cut from lightweight shell fabric. This piece is fully lined with max durability, featuring a boxy fit. Car jacket appears in blue and black wash. So I really like that. Overdyed, nice contrasting stitch, nice big pockets. Pockets everywhere, basically. Pockets, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 pockets that we can see, plus probably some more. There's probably a pocket within another pocket. So I like that they've done this, because I guess it's purposefully done in order to give people jackets that you can stash things in, or you can keep phones in, keep cameras in and shit. That's quite cool. Or obviously drogas. I'm not really too fond of the logo on the back here. Probably it's a bit overkill for me, although I do like its tonal, because that's one thing. If you're going to do big branding, at least do it tonal embroidering or something, so it's not standing out from a fucking mile off and I don't look like a walking fucking billboard. But it is a nice shape. It is a nice wash. I do like everything about it. And it actually is a pretty decent price also. I'm not really too mad at that. And I think maybe that pocket, this almost like, you know, I don't know what you call that shape, but this pocket on the inside, it seems like one of their little design staples. On maybe on the inside left of their pocket down there, it's a little secret little stash pocket that they always have. So I really got that. Like that. Continuing on, you got another look here with the, is that okay? That's the same jacket we saw above with the matching pants, I think, or maybe those are the double knee pants. I'm not too sure, but that look is fucking banging. Right, that is a really fucking good look. So supremely styled. And then you've also got this great jacket here. Almost looks like a work jacket or flight jacket with two big zips here on the front and a zip on the side. You've got a t-shirt that says hydrate yourself. I love that. That's really fucking cool. You got another one where she's wearing a bikini top and some boiler room sweatpants. Oh, that's kind of hard. I'm not going to lie. I wonder why they put the logo at the back like that and not the front. That's kind of a cool little twist, isn't it? Usually when you're doing a logo on a pair of sweatpants, they usually go just underneath here on the pocket towards the front, but they put it here at the back. Interesting. And then you've also got this tie-dye hoodie. That's really cool as well. So yeah, big up all the team. There's a team of people that did it. Photography, what's that? Vasilias Kaligias. And stylist is Charlotte Moss and everybody else included. You guys fucking smashed it. Boiler Room, Spring, Summer 2024. It looks fucking amazing. I love everything about it. I love everything fucking about it. Okay? Cool. Next on the list, we have this great news regarding Samuel Ross. Samuel Ross, formerly of a Cold War, I reported or spoke about here on my podcast that he sold 100% stake in his company to the Tomorrow Limited Group. It's now going to be helmed by two different people who I think are already working out of Cold War, who are now going to be responsible for everything that you see there. And he's now going to be pursuing his own creative endeavors. And one of the things that he's doing, which is, again, a clear indication that he's trying to move away from fashion, maybe he's just bored of it and wants to do other things, is that he's now been appointed as the artistic director for the London Design Biennale Biennale in 2025. So this is a clear indication that he's probably quite done with fashion for now. Maybe he'll pick it up later on down the line, but it seems like he really does want to make a hard pivot into the design and art world. There was that really cool feature or profile on him in the Financial Times I remember reading a couple of years ago that was really cool, that kind of gave you a hint that he was kind of steering himself in this direction. And I guess he's now putting the final steps into being a legit designer, a legit architect, a legit product designer outside of fashion. Which is pretty cool to see, to be fair, because like I said, I honestly did think he was going to try and take a Cold War to heady heights and maybe allow it to be, or maybe try and build it in the direction of being the UK version of like Imperial Armani. But clearly he has like loftier goals. So let's kind of read the article here. It says Samuel Ross is set to take on the role of artistic director at the London Design Biennale in 2025. The landmark event, which takes place in Somerset House every 2 years, will be curated by Ross and will be filled with work by international designers. Outposts and concepts will differ, but each project will work towards a theme set by Ross. Alongside his appointment, London Design Biennale revealed that the theme chosen by Ross for 2025 will be surface reflections. This will manifest an exploration of self and how our histories and our life journeys influence the people who we become. The quote from him: "The elder and the child versions of ourselves in spirit harvest experiences pulled from the same well. The time between each visit to the well does not distort the composition of the water, a different reflection or a means of extractions, but may occur over time. Due to the compound characteristics, generations of design thinkers portray similar behaviors." I love the guy, but he does love to fucking just say words, right? He does love a good fucking word salad. But one of the good things about his pivot to this whole design world is that this sort of stuff is way more indulged. People love this. People love when people are wordy. They love when they're heady. They love when they're esoteric. They love when they're almost avant-garde. They love when they're really in their shit and they take themselves and measure. Like, the more seriously you take yourselves, the more seriously they'll take you and the bigger fans they are of what you say and what you do. So he'll actually be received way better, I think, in the design world, oddly enough, than he ever was. I predict he will definitely get way more respect from the design world people than he ever did get from the fashion people, from the streetwear people, and whatever else it may be. They just seem to love that, especially with him being a legit intellectual and clearly somebody who takes himself legitimately seriously and loves to talk about himself, loves to talk about his work and what goes into it and whatnot. They're going to love it. So I'm almost certain this is going to be a barnstorming success. And obviously to see somebody that looks like that, who's from ENDS, doing what he's doing at that level, again, you can't deny, you can't hate on that. It's fucking incredible. Somerset House as well. Absolutely beautiful building, isn't it? I used to work there back in the day for a couple of startups and shit. They had like a little startup incubator, like whatever, White Combinator type of thing down below. And it was the same place actually that I remember meeting Charles Jeffrey Loverboy for the first time. Charles Jeffrey was launching his brand the same time I was working for this startup, and I actually met him a few times. And he is absolutely lovely. Charles Jeffrey might be the nicest person I've ever met in fashion. And you'd think he wouldn't. Well, how he presents himself, his type of fashion, the crew he hangs around with, you'd think he'd be up his own ass, but he's not. He's so sweet, so nice, legitimately like a very, very good guy. Always went out of his way to say hi and shoot the shit and stop and chat and entertain some of my nonsense ramblings about fashion. So I've always got a special place in my heart for Charles Jeffrey. And it's great to see Loverboy doing such bits now at the moment. And it's great to see that fucking woolly hat, right, with the fucking ears on it, right, that little bunny ear, whatever, woolly hat that all the blacks seem to fucking love. I love that it's doing fucking numbers in the hood because he's a really good guy. Continuing on, Sammy Ross was the founder of a Cold War and SRA, as well as the Black British Artist Grants Program, will devise a program that brings works by industry-leading figures to the Central London landmark. In addition, he will be debuting a series of new large-scale sculptural works in the courtyard, marking his first major UK installation. Wow. His first exhibition he had actually was in a White Cube in Bermondsey. I remember I went to the last day of that. Fucking nuts, right? So he's going to have a big installation, obviously fitted into the courtyard there. That's going to be pretty cool to see. I actually watched the XX in this courtyard as well many years ago when they were first coming up. I actually watched the XX play in this fucking Somerset House courtyard during the summer. Absolutely beautiful. We continue here. He says, London's consistent spirit of experimentation and palpable artistic culture remain a fresh forum for global thinking. Taking part in the 2025 Design Biennale as artistic director is an honor. I look forward to the collaboration with each practitioner, ideally fueling a spirit of experimentation, blurring the edges of where design meets art. Ross follows in the footsteps of 2023 artist director Eric Chen, who invited participants to explore how design can be a facilitator to working together under complex circumstances. The Design Biennale is set to take place on June 5th to June 29th in 2025. So I'm definitely going to be there. Big up to Sammy Ross. Godspeed to him on this new journey. He's going to fucking smash it. He's going to fucking smash it. We all bloody know that to be true. We all bloody know that to be true, don't we? Let's not fucking play about. Let's not play about. Moving on. Let's play this clip here. We've got this clip courtesy of Takashi Murakami, where he is debuting some new sandals that he is designing in collaboration with Complex. This also, funny enough, might be the reason why Takashi Murakami went on a bit of a rant a few weeks ago, where he was basically complaining about being overworked. He was complaining about all the projects that he has done, that he has to do, the fact that he has so many deadlines approaching, the fact that he can't see any women, the fact that he's stuck in his office all the time. He even showed the camera a jar full of like toenail clippings or like stuff from his feet. He showed like in his studio, he has this like cardboard bed he sleeps in because he can't leave because there's so many stuff to do, and he was crying, complaining. But this might be the reason why he's crying and complaining. Maybe Complex were the one that killing him. Complex were killing him by trying to make him make these fucking shitty sandals. And now he's made them. He seems to be very happy that he's got them off his shoulder and they're off the dock and he can move into other projects. But let's actually watch the video. I think it's quite fucking funny to see him all happy about these little sandals that he made.
Hello, this is Takashi. Today is I am promoting for the my new project for the, a sandal. Because
I'm not gonna lie, I was generally surprised when I heard Takashi Murakami can speak English, but it also makes sense why he makes so much money now. It almost makes sense why he's also so fucking wealthy. He's one of the most premier contemporary artists out there at the moment, sculptor, and whatever else you want to call him in between. And he can also speak English, so his client base is legitimately international. So, but I was legitimately surprised he could speak English. I'm not going to lie. I thought he was going to be like a Nigo type where he kind of speaks through a translator or through nods or through kind of sounds. But the fact that he can speak English explains a lot why he's so fucking paid.
You know, I am every day to using for the sandal in Japanese local stuff. I am making for with a collaboration this company also. But network company approached me.
I'm not going to lie. I think I actually prefer the sandals that he was holding up. These sandals, I don't know what brand these are. These burgundy, almost like cement, brick looking, clay looking sandals. They actually look far better. They almost look like, dare I say it, traditional. They look a little bit old manish. Right, it's kind of, I guess, one piece, but it's made to look like it's like a couple of pieces. I actually prefer this design. I probably would have liked to have seen him do an edit of this design with the flower design he's already done, as opposed to what he kind of did now, which is more of a Yeezy contemporary type of style. And judging by what he's saying, he's collaborating with Network. That's the company that bought Complex, right? And fired a bunch of people. It's that kind of online live shopping thing. That I don't know how they had the money to buy Complex, to be fair, because, you know, judging by the videos and some of the, you know, content they have online, it doesn't seem like a lot of people kind of know about Network or the, you know, the platform, the brand, the app. But I guess they're making some bunch of money. But they recently bought Complex. They recently fired a bunch of people. But I guess now they're putting out some sandals and shit.
I am making for with a collaboration this company also. But Network company approached me, you know, please making for the sandal. And then now, so we made a kind
Ooh,
of...
Oh, it actually looks quite cool. I'm not going to lie. It looks quite cool. So if you're not seeing the picture, it's that it's the iconic Takeshi Murakami sunflower design that he's known for with the happy face in the middle. That happy face is almost like the strap of the sandal. And then the rest of the sandal is kind of... looks like clouds, but it's all monotone. It's just all green, all red, I'm assuming. But it looks pretty cool. Once he's got them in his hand, I think on the feet they look a bit naff, but they look quite interesting in the hand. Wonder how much they'll be. £200? More than £100? More than £300? I wonder how much they'll be. They'll definitely be collector's items because they're made by Takeshi Murakami. People will collect them and just put them on ice. But they look really cool.
Right. This is a kind of the, you know, art project. I am, you know, I don't know, like so much far away.
Right? Imagine making sandals and calling them an art project. That's such a flex, isn't it? An art project collaboration pair of sandals that, you know, some people are going to resell for fucking hundreds of thousands of dollars. And some people are just going to wear them into the ground and take them when they're going fucking, you know, flower shopping at Columbia Road Market and shit. I love it.
But, you know, step by step, I want to make it for the sandal. I used to make it for the sneaker like several years ago because I came to the Complex Con first time. Everybody knows my name was, you know, very surprising because why I'm very famous. I couldn't understand. But the reason came from the, you know, collaboration with Kanye. So, and then, okay, so I am already, you know, into the sneaker industry, but that's why, you know, I made a sneaker in my, you know, concept. And then collaboration with Porter, and, you know, I, you know, asking for the sneaker people, the OEM. So, spend a lot of money, you know, we lose a huge amount of money. Like, who won? This is a customer won, right? So I lose in the business, because cannot make it for the many stuff, but we made, we using for the, you know, long time and testing. For example, okay, so this sandal project is...
Oh, look all the tests. I love that. I love all the tests he's showing here. Pretty cool.
You know, very...
different type of molds and shapes he's got here, one pieces. A lot of them look very similar to like, the stuff that you see Yeezy have kind of done over the years. Again, that aesthetic, unfortunately, has been now... owned by Yeezy, even though they're probably not the first person to do it. That sort of like one piece PU and type of molding, rubbery, plasticky type of look of a sandal that you know Yeezy likes to be.
In a long time.
And then, oh, you've also got classic ones with materials, one with just a strap with the flower on top of it.
Do that, right?
Oh, the colors look so good.
It's, you know,
Oh, I love those. That one at the top there. I don't know if that's like a skull design, whatever that is there. That is fucking hard. I love these. These might be my favorite ones there. They almost look like a crocky shape at the front. Very boxy, very square. But they've also got these really cool designs and faces that look like skulls on the top of it. All kind of, you know, they're all kind of piled up on top of each other. They look really cool.
Many, many stuff. Many stuff.
Oh, there's another one down there too. That's really cool, like a Vizrim.
So, and looks like that.
Oh, look at the sole. The sole is cool. Right. The outsole is really nice as well. Many stuff. It's covered in little designs as well. Little lines.
So, and looks like
that. I'm not mad at that. So it's got all the sunflowers underneath as well. And another big sunflower thing on the outstep, which is weird. It should be maybe on the instep as an arch thing. This one should be there, maybe. But yeah, I love that.
That, right? It's everything is, you know, testing. This is a oh my god, this is very heavy.
Ooh, love that.
Heavy weight, right? So this stuff is, you know, management in network.
So anyway, that's what he says. They're going to be releasing soon. I guess Complex Con or network events happening soon. Keep an eye out for that. Takeshi Murakami Complex Network collaboration with these really cool sandals. They should be available for you to purchase very, very, very soon. Keep an eye out for that shit if you like it. Keep an eye out for that stuff if you like it. That's all you have to do. Just keep an eye out for it, all right? Cool. Moving on from that, let's talk about the main thing I want to talk about today, which is Tyler Creator's Louis Vuitton Spring 2024 capsule collection, which has finally dropped on the retail stores, and there's some additional imagery to go with it too. I initially said when I saw this stuff, although it was very impressive to see how polished it was for somebody like a Tyler who's mostly been doing streetwear and what you'd maybe deem to be menswear nowadays, with the stuff that he's been doing with golf, on Le Fleur, right, and stuff what else he's been doing in terms of actual cut and sew pieces. But to go into an actual fashion house like Louis Vuitton and be able to present your ideas at that level and it still look very polished and it still look very much like you without it looking sloppy, scrappy, whatever it may be, is incredible. Obviously, they probably would have never let that happen because they're a multi-million dollar fucking business and shit. There's a level of polish that they're always going to have. But I still feel like the ideas at their core, the storytelling that he's able to kind of depict in this shit is fucking phenomenal. If anything, apart from that, I don't think the clothes are that different to the stuff that he does in his own stuff. I think, if anything, some of the accessories, some of the shoes, some of the bags are probably some of the most interesting pieces. And maybe just the novelty of owning stuff designed by Tyler that's also done in conjunction with Pharrell at Louis Vuitton, considering their history, considering that house, considering the connection with Virgil, RIP and shit. That's enough of a reason to have this stuff in your archive, in your collection anyway. But if you're a fan of this type of aesthetic, you could probably get it for far cheaper in, you know, in some iteration within, you know, Tyler, the Creator's many brands that he has now at the moment. But regardless of that, one thing he does do incredibly well is the imagery, is all of the activations, all of the presentations that go on with his work. That stuff is always going to be A1 and it all looks fucking sublime. But these bags, look at these fucking bags. Oh, fucking beautiful. If I'm not mistaken, the monogram print on these massive keep-all bags in these various sizes have been all hand-drawn. So everything has been hand-drawn, obviously printed on these fucking pieces of leather, which is fucking cool. So you get this really kind of like nice DIY effect on these bags that are incredibly polished, incredibly expensive and luxurious. You get this really DIY aspect to it, which kind of draws back to the era of kind of draws back to his kind of history, starting off kind of drawing, you know, early, you know, Odd Future golf line sheets and lookbooks and pieces and notebooks and stuff, to go from being that kid that was drawing all that stuff on the back of a napkin paper or on the back of a notebook or in the back of a moleskin, and now you're doing it at Louis Vuitton. Incredible. I also love the fact that he featured Jason Jules, also known as Garmsville. Big up him. I've known him for a while from like the London scene and shit. He's a top boy. He also co-put out this book called Black Ivy, which I haven't really ever got a hold of, but if you ever read the book Take Ivy, you'd know that it's kind of loosely based on that, but obviously through a black perspective in terms of, you know, black people's you know, contribution to fashion overall. It's very, very well regarded. I missed out on the exhibition. I think the exhibition was like Missing Threads or something like that happened in Somerset House, so I was bummed I missed that out. But ever since that exhibition, ever since that book, him and Tyler have struck up a relationship, which is pretty cool because they have a similar sort of style and aesthetic. So it's cool to see him being embraced and being used in the lookbook. This shirt he's wearing actually is actually beautiful, I'm not going to lie. The colors, the bag, Like, that's actually really nice. I think that's one of my favorite styled looks in this actual campaign, what Jason Jules is wearing, where he's got this really amazing, almost silk looking shirt. And then underneath here, you've got this lime green jacket that's wrapped around his shoulders, which is kind of something that he would do in a knot, right? And then you've also got this lovely bag. This satchel is probably one of my favorite bags, actually, in the entire collection. This kind of almost half shell clam type of style bag with this nice leather latch here. Looks fucking beautiful. And he's also wearing some sandals there with the socks. And there's also a golf bag there. Another bag here, too, with some tags on it as well that look like fucking flowers. So big up him and a few other pieces as well. But the prices are nothing to be smirched at. If you actually go on the Louis Vuitton website, they're all available now to kind of check out. The prices are no fucking joke, that's for sure, which you should expect. It's fucking Louis Vuitton, but the prices are no joke. That big jacket that he's got in the actual header picture here underneath is actually, how much is it, they say? It's 2,450. The Kipao Bandoulière 50 bag is 2,400. I'm not gonna lie, maybe it's me. If I had 2,400, if I had £2,500 to spare, I'm not gonna lie, I would probably buy a bag over a jacket. Even though I'm a premier jacket boy, if I had £2,500 to spare, I'd probably buy a bag over a jacket, because this bag would last you forever. Legitimately, it will last you for fucking ever. It could turn into your new travel bag. You could floss and take that to fucking the gym and shit, right? It could be fucking crazy. But I'd actually buy the bag over the jacket. But regardless, you got great varsity jackets here. You got a nice backpack. There's a reversible craggy bucket hat. There's a dandy loafers for $8.95. What else do we have here featured? Some good shit, to be fair. It's a lot of it, but some good shit. This is a really nice jean set. I really love the monogram denim jean set. Is really fucking beautiful. I'm assuming this has been embossed or something along those kind of lines. And you've also got the obviously the hand-drawn Louis Vuitton things all over the outside of it that have been kind of stitched. That looks fucking incredible. The craftsmanship on that is fucking nuts. You've got mini Kipao bandoliers there. You've got a nice belt. You've got a pouch there. Your card holders, $235. That might be one of the popular ones because it's one of the cheapest things on there. A crew neck shirt is £740. Jesus Christ, they're not playing games, are they? $740 for a pink t-shirt. God damn. You forget what these upper brands are doing, innit? You've got fucking Taco there as well in the lookbook, which is cool in the campaign. These guys have been friends for literally, you know, decades, it feels like. So it's cool to see them still friends to this day. Oh, you've got this really cool tracksuit. This tracksuit is fucking beautiful, actually. That tracksuit is nice. This knitted collar embroidered technical blouson, and as well as the trousers. Oof, I love this. That is really cool. That tracksuit is amazing. I'd wear the fuck. I think it's a tracksuit. I don't know if it is, but I'd wear it together. I quite like that. I'm not really a fan of the LV trainer, so I'll skip that. I don't really care about the LV trainer. You've got the standard, you know, quintessential Tyre the Creator Fair Isle wool vest as well there. You've got a nice pair of, like, what they're called, tailored China trousers. You've got a nice messenger bag. That's really beautiful. I'd wear the fuck out of this, actually. This is actually really cool. That messenger bag is beautiful. I love that. You've also got a pouch there, envelope pouch. You've got a pocket organizer. Some really, really good stuff here, not gonna lie. The cardigan is not too deep, not too bad, as is the soft mini trunk bag, which probably could double up as a good DJ bag. I wouldn't deny that to be the case. You got that green bag, you got the Kipao in that green print as well that I fucking love. That's fucking beautiful, I'm not going to lie. I wonder how much this bag is here, this one that I like that Jason Jules is wearing in this look. I wonder how much that particular bag is. I'm assuming it's probably going to be about 1,000 as well. But that particular shape, oh, there it is. It's called a man, what's it called? It's called a Montessoris messenger bag. This is fucking beautiful. It's one of my favorite ones there. £1,910. This is definitely one of my favorite bags in the entire collection. I think it looks amazing. Perfect size for most dudes to put most shit inside of it. I love the inside features, that whole dog illustration as well. Nice leather on the outside, the nice monogram print. The raw leather feel on the straps as well. The big kind of what you call it, tag there as well. You probably put some extra tags also there. There's a towel set. There's what's that? There's a Vivian Golf. There's a bag with tees. It's really extensive. Really extensive collection. Trucker hats. You've also got even fragrance as well included. You've also got some jewelry too. You've got this Paradise Stone necklace included there. All very Tyler the Creator-esque as well. I love everything about it. I love everything about it. Of course, if you've got the funds, you can check it out. Available now at LouisVuitton.com. Available now at LouisVuitton.com. Love to fucking see it. Personally, would I like to see Tyler at Louis Vuitton anytime soon? Not now. I think give the guy time. I don't think there should be any rush to give him any sort of like high fashion job. Even though I say at the time when he was presenting one of his latest collection, I think he did a collaboration with Lacoste recently. And I said the stuff he's doing with Lacoste was just as good as any stuff I've seen during Paris Fashion Week for men's. But I still think he has plenty of time to do that later on in his career. Having been a big fan of Tyler, watching a lot of his interviews and shit, I get the feeling he's probably not at that stage just yet. He probably has a lot more to kind of give in terms of music, and then he might want to transition. And even if he went through the same thing at the same time, I don't think he could. I don't think he could legitimately do everything he does now and also run a fashion house and also be somewhat sane. I think that'll take a lot out of him. He's also somebody that doesn't like to live in Europe. He complains about Europe. He complains about London often, you know, having to live here full time or most of the time. I'm not sure if he could even handle that really going forward. So there's a lot to think about in terms of that sort of stuff. But one thing is for certain, when it comes to actually producing the actual work, putting out the collections and kind of competing on that level, he can obviously do it, because the imagery, the offerings available, the taste level, the finish of it is all really fucking good. Like, let's not lie, it's all really fucking good, to the point where there are people out there legitimately saying that he should be given a job after Pharrell gets the boot or when he leaves or something along those kind of lines. Again, I think probably it's a bit too much for him right now. Because I think, if anything, if you give him the job, the unfortunate thing of it is that most likely he'll just do variations of this collection season in, season out, and then people will be complaining that he does the same thing all the time, which he always does, but he just refines stuff. So you have to be careful what you wish for. But I am a big fan of him. I do love what he does. I do love what he presents. And I'm hoping that now he's proved that he can compete with the big dogs at this level. And if the opportunity does come about where there's an opportunity to work for one of those big brands or those big houses, he'll be maybe considered for that role. I'm a big fan of his, always have been a big fan of his, and I'm happy to see his ascent continue. I'm happy to see his fucking ascent continue. So that has been, for me, the Agostino Zynga Show, episode number 755. Thanks so much for tuning in. It's been a pleasure to have your company. If it's your first time checking out the show, you know what to do. Smash the like button down below. That'd be much appreciated. If you're watching or listening, sorry, via the podcast app, make sure you leave me a 5-star review on Spotify, on Apple, on any other platform you listen to this podcast. Please leave me a 5-star review. Links to all my social media feeds and accounts and SoundClouds and shit can be found in the description down below. There's also going to be a link to my tune of the day, which is, for me, if I'm not mistaken, Skywater. Is it Sky? Yeah, I think it's Skywater. Water, Rain, if I'm not mistaken. Is that the tune of the day? Is that tune of the day, Skywalker Rain? Or am I mistaken? Yeah, it's Skywater Rain. Check it out. Tune of the day. We're playing with my voice right now. If you enjoy it, let me know. For the rest of you watching live via the live stream, thank you for tuning in. The screen is on the face of black. It's been a pleasure to have your company. Make sure you smash that like button. I'll see you guys again very, very soon. But for now, take care, people. Peace. I must be a clown. You're smiling in my face. You're playing in my face. You're looking for another sign. I'm on your for your page. And I can't stop the rain from coming. Tequila flowing, music pumping. But I can't stop the rain. Hey, tell me something. Cause you've been bluffing. And I've been doing the same. Yeah, wish I had all the receipts to get my time back. You caught you a platinum bitch, like how you find that? Make me feel so fucking stupid, way on my deck. Girl, I can't. So I'm back to the road, yeah. Since I hit my phone, yeah. We stick to the code. You a demon, baby. But fuck what they say. We just woke up in bed. Rick on hoodie for my baby head. Tied right at this vibrate. He never come outside when I lights out. We done scared him straight. Still can't stop that rain. Still can't stop that rain. Still can't stop that rain. I wanna pop that hoe.
Fuck around, rinse my pain. Yeah, my money the same. This bitch is the same. Still fucking a lame.
What?
You rocking my shit. I gave him a pass, but just for today. If I give you my hand, then you promise to stay. I left bread in your room. This is just for today. Can't stop the pain from growing. Tequila flowing, my music pumping. But I can't stop the rain. You tell me something, cause you've been bluffing. And I've been doing the same.
Yeah, wish I had all the receipts to get my time back. Yeah, you caught you a platinum bitch, like how you find that? Make me feel so fucking stupid, way on my deck. Girl, I can't, I can't.